All right, the recorder's on.
Okay, let's see. Let's start the regular meeting and, let's see, about this one. Regular meeting of the North Bend Planning Commission for Thursday, May 24th, 2018. Let's see, we'll call this meeting to order just after 7, and we'll do a roll call. We have some new commissioners present. James Beavers?
Bovers.
Bovers?
Present.
And Scott Greenberg?
Present.
All right. Dick Ryan?
Present.
Harry Miller?
Present.
Gary Toe?
Tao. Present.
All right. Good thing the other Gary left, otherwise there'd be two Scotts and two Garys.
My brother's name.
Gary. Okay. And Scott Heller, I'm here. Do you want to do some of the greetings and welcome?
I thought we might do, I wrote a couple of notes down that since we have some new commissioners here to probably get into it. And I think it'd be a good idea if each of the commissioners just kind of said, I mean, even the ones that are here, just as a kind of meet and greet, get to know everybody, who you are, what you do for a living, and what made you interested in being on the commission.
Sure. I'll start. James Bovers, obviously. Like I said before, I work for Tanner Electric. First came to the first meeting back in January. It was kind of my first introduction to Planning Commission and what it was, and got really interested in it. Geography, I have a geography degree. Planning and zoning classes came with that, and so I had a little bit of experience there. At least knew what you guys were talking about, but was very interested. I felt like I wanted to be involved and, you know, have a say and some opinion, something like that, and decided to join up.
Great.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I'm Scott Heller. I've been on the Planning Commission about 3 years now. Recently elected the chair after Gary Fancher left, which we do need to elect a vice chair. So chat about that as Elizabeth left. I was just got interested through all the developments that came about, just as you all probably did. But 3 years ago there was less. Now there's a lot more going on. I've learned a lot in the last 3 years. I didn't know much before, honestly. So anyone that comes in with experience, you know, you're gonna just hit the ground running at that point. But it took me a little while to get up to speed. Still learning plenty, but kind of understand the process much better. I work at Puget Sound Energy. I've been there 9 years and work as a biologist on their hydropower projects. I have an environmental science degree. And just looking forward to meeting everyone and got a new crew here. So.
I'm Scott Greenberg. Live in the Silver Creek neighborhood just outside the city limits. My property line is the city limits, so what happens in the city does affect me. For the next week, I am Development Services Director for the City of Mercer Island. Then I will be retiring from my urban planning career and devoting all my time to my winery, Convergent Zone Cellars, that I run out of my property here in North Bend. And will be a full-time winery owner, winemaker, whatever else comes with that, in addition to doing the honeydew list, which is growing as we speak. I've also been a planning commissioner previously and an elected official, so I kind of have all that experience. And I probably attended more planning commission meetings as staff than I care to, mm-hmm. to think about.
Hey, Ryan. Been retired from warehouses for 25 years. Spent my career with a warehouser in Coos Bay as a forester, ground forester, and came up here on a promotion to land use manager for the Sun Quality River course. Finished out my career here, worked with the warehouser, lived in Newcastle though, all those years, because a lot of my effort was between Federal Way and the valley here, but my office was here in the mill site. Took no retirement. My wife of 40 years, or more than 40 years, as she lived, but she had Parkinson's for 25 of those years. So I was a full-time caregiver, joyfully, until she ended. while I was a browser forester and land use manager, I also had responsibilities for land acquisitions and dispositions. And I was very pleased to find a buyer and buy Rattlesnake Ridge. We sold that off for cash to TPL. They held it in lieu of a fee for the county or the state when they really get funds to purchase it outright. And during that process with TPL, we also doubled the size of Mountside Conservation Area, got the Worthy lands out of that pocket, sold the top of Mount Washington to the state of Washington. And so we weren't thinking about leaving back in those years, but we knew it was coming, so I took the opportunity to kind of make things right before I got out of the way. So my legacy is Rattlesnake Ridge, of course, and I have a chance to see it. We live now in the Middle Fork River right on Tanner Road, where all the activities going on. As Scott and I are neighbors, we know the activity going there a lot. My background in land use planning, I think, gives me an opportunity to be of some benefit here. I did a lot of work with the county when they were creating the zones back in the mid-80s. Ended up working with that. I'm also a commissioner on the World Forest Commission. I'm a board chairman of the King Conservation District as well. So I wear a lot of hats in my retirement, but I feel more comfortable wearing hats than being bald.
You look good in a hat, so it works.
I'm going to follow that up with something. I'll keep the hat on the baldness, hopefully. Anytime soon. I'm Mary Miller. I'm a longtime professional photographer. Started out about 38 years in the industry, evolved from photojournalism to where I'm at now, which is a private business locally owned. And I'm your city photographer. I'm very proud and happy to be able to say that. So I might be photographing this young man here one day.
Good.
I just did, you know, and I'll be out there all the time. My point is that I'm at all the events that the city holds out. I see a lot because of it, not only recording for historical value, which is extremely important, by the way, and embracing the possibilities of all things positive as well, but it's the truth. Above everything else, it is the truth of what I seek out there. So this is a very important thing to be actually affiliated, and I'm very honored to be here. I'm learning a lot, and I've only been a commissioner for the last 2 years, so I come to this very new, and so a lot of the verbiage and the wording, I'm constantly learning, and the reading is just fine by me, but it's taxing at points, but it's very necessary, and I'm very proud and privileged to be a part of it, and I'm very glad to have all of our new commissioners on board. I welcome you personally, and Dick, and Scott, and let's have some fun while we do some great things, possibly, and hopefully. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm Gary Tao. I'm currently a manager with Boeing. I'm in their corporate HR human resources organization. I manage a variety of the benefit programs that Boeing offers employees. Before that, and for a longer period of time, I was a manager in their facilities organization, and I was responsible for multiple Boeing site locations in Puget Sound, strategic planning, facilities, and property management. I've also served a couple of terms as an elected official in the city of Des Moines, where I worked really closely with the city's planning commission and some of the other citizen volunteer committees, and I really grew to appreciate the work that they did, the role they played in the city. My wife and I moved to North Bend about 5 years ago. We live in a fairly new development, Cedar Falls, and we just have fallen in love with the area. Part of what we love, besides just the whole environment, is when we go to different places and see all those historical photos. I mean, it just really, just puts all the things in perspective where you see where we came from. So I totally agree that that historical record just helps people connect to the communities and the past and legacies and all that sort of appreciate and admire what you do in that role long term that you serve. So, I've been active here in North Bend, in the Snoqualmie Valley, as a baseball umpire
for youth baseball, so I don't recognize any faces here as a room.
It's not a perfect segue. You know, you can get yelled at as an umpire or as a planet enemy.
So, right. So I do wear the mask and try to stay as incognito as possible.
I'm going to watch for it now.
Hey, oh, you've probably seen me out there. You've probably never seen me. So I do have some thick skin, and I'm not afraid to have good dialogue and debate on things. So I really feel honored, as Mary said, to be part of the group, and I'll be learning my questions. You know, I have a few tonight. They're definitely coming from the rookie side of the Planning Commission, so I'll apologize in advance for that. But I'm surely excited about the opportunity of working with all of you and kind of working through some of the big things that are going on here.
What a great group. You know, we're all really excited about, you know, the volunteerism and the talent and the returning commissioners as well, and how you guys have stepped up. So I think we have a tremendous commission here, and I think we have a tremendous staff. And what I wanted to do, we've never done this before, and I thought if I just took a minute and let you know, we have different assignments in the staff. Some are responsible for certain things, and I think it would be helpful for you to know that. And if you're going to get a hold of somebody on a particular subject, you know who the expert is on staff. So what we have is I'm the director, and I'm pretty much just management, which means I'm not an expert on anything. And you all will meet our public works director, Mark Regals, who's also deputy city manager. And Mark is a very, very high energy guy that has really taken our capital improvement program and really put some wheels on it. He's done a lot in the public works area to bring this community way along from a lot of challenges. And we have a lot of old infrastructure. We are expanding our sewer plant. We are doing water improvements. There's just a whole lot going on. So Mark has been very impressive. He has about 20 years experience working for engineering firms, most of it land development. So he was a great pick for here because that's a large part of what we're doing. He has two employees you'll probably see coming in here quite often, two development engineers that work in land development, Brian Tucker and Mike Sippo, and both of them are really top drawer guys, and they're both particular experts in stormwater and some of the requirements that are very complicated here. A lot of people have soils that won't take the percolation rates that we have here, so they do a lot more detention. We do a lot of percolation here, but we also have a high water table, and it doesn't work in some circumstances. So you need some creative solutions, and that's why we see some of these incredible structures being built underground to retain water here. In addition to that, on our staff, Mike, our senior planner, is the planner in charge of the Planning Commission. So he's in charge of the agendas and the minutes, and he really is doing a great job with that. He's a good resource for you if you need to call and say, hey, what's coming up, or if you find something that you want to chat about early on, a staff report, he can either direct you to the planner who drafted it, or he can, you know, handle it himself. He just took his AICP test and passed.
Congratulations.
Yay. And that's the American Institute of Certified Planners. It is an honor to get that, and you have to take 32 units each year of accredited, and the national office has to accredit them, classes to keep your certification. So you have to keep current, and you've got to keep on top of things. And really proud of him passing that. Jamie Burrell is our other senior planner. She's responsible for Community and Economic Development Council of the Subcommittee. So a committee of there are council members, three of them, that is a council subcommittee. And the way this council works here is a little different than other councils I've seen. They don't agendize any items for action until it goes through a committee. So either it'll go through a finance committee, an economic development committee, it goes through the public works committee, or the community and economic development committee. So what's nice about that is there's a total vetting of the subject before those committees. And then when it gets to the council, you have some resources on the council that are much more versed in the particular topic. And they generally, if an item is introduced out of their committee, they will comment on it, and usually after the staff report, make the motion to approve. and they can answer a lot of technical questions at the council level. So it really is a real strong tool for council members to be able to dialogue on a higher level, and it works very well. We also have Jesse Reynolds new with us. We're very happy to have Jesse here. He's our long-range planner. We have a lot of code updates. With all the development we have going on, you'll know this, Scott, that you've got to give precedent to those time-sensitive things which are permitting, and you don't want to let go of the long-range stuff or some of the other things that you do to try to really keep up with your comp plan, keep up with your buildable lands, your critical area review. There's a couple things we're doing that I wanted to tell you about that you'll see later, but that we're spreading our staff out to do so that we keep up with mandates. And we have Tom Meager, who's our permit technician, and he's amazing. He handles so much. In the cities I've been in, you usually have three permit techs doing what he's doing. One of the things we did today, and Lynn is our other planner, Lynn's also our economic development manager, and she's really stepping into that right now. She's moving away from projects and into more proactive economic development, and I'll tell you about a couple of things she's heading up. She also is the staff member who's a liaison to our downtown merchants group, and she's really mobilized a lot of merchant activities. And she and Bree, her assistant, are the ones who have organized like the trick-or-treat street and the Christmas tree lighting and some of the great activities we have, celebrations. And I think it's really great to have an economic and community development department that's concerned about community building, which really happens on a personal level, not necessarily a built level. So we get very involved in the sort of esprit de corps of the city, which I think is really, really important, and she's fantastic with that. And I'll tell you about some of the activities she's involved with here. What we do here, by the way, for resources, and I'm sure all of you know this, but we generally keep two screens open, and one of them usually has our North Bend Municipal Code on one and then the project on the other. Just wanted to let you know, on our webpage, we have great resources, and we're redoing the webpage. And you can find the municipal code and look things up on that, not have to flip through, you know, pages. And also our comp plans on there. So if you need to take a look at either of those for references, we're going through these things, they're available there. And there's some good references online. Also, some of the major projects that we're doing, we're going to be bringing into you quite soon the update of our current projects map, and we'd like to walk through that with you and show you what's going on out there. So when you have a question like you did, Scott, you'll have it. We'll provide that to you in electronic format so you can have it at home. We're going to try to connect it on our website so that you can pop onto a project and then get the history and where are they now and when's it going to break ground, or, you know, when's it going vertical, and when do they plan on opening or selling homes, so that everybody will have that current information. I think that's very valuable. And we should have that up and running, I think, within the next month, the way that the program is going right now. Some of the major initiatives that we're doing that you might be interested in is Jesse's working on some very early work for next year. We're going to be into the buildable lands requirement, and the state is going through that, and we'll be providing data. And with Jesse is very well versed and a specialist in GIS, and that's one of the reasons that we put him on board for long-range planning, to keep our mapping up, to keep things current, to be able to update, to be able to use maps as communication devices and getting more information out to you. And Jesse's involved now in looking at what our historic trends have been for both population and employment, and how that's changing dramatically now with the housing we have, and trying to get a good baseline as to what we're building now, because our growth rate is completely wacko now, and we have to make projections and figure out what are we going to have in the future. And we're using up a lot of the lands that are larger for single family, where all the demand is. So this is kind of a blip, and I expect it to slow down. We're also probably going to have some economic changes in the next 2 years. So he's got the task of kind of wending through all of that and saying, what should our projections look like? So he's working on that. We're also in the midst right now, we're hiring a group, ESA, a consulting group, to update our critical lands and shoreline regulations, because there's some new mandates down from the state, and we'll be updating those and bringing them to you for a recommendation to the council to adopt. We also are in the midst of some studies that you might want to know about. There are two studies that are using a technique of collecting fees from development, which are called mitigation fees, which are different than impact fees. But they're determined by background studies very, very similarly. And the reason we're doing it is one is for bike and ped trails, because we just can't in our parks program or in our street program. We have so many capital improvement requirements that are basic and kind of backbone needs that we don't get to the trails and the for bike and ped. We're pretty good at grantsmanship. We pull quite a bit of money in, but we think that there should be a contribution to the developments to try to connect them to those trails and do the trails that are in their immediate area and provide additional resources for our trail system, because that is really one of our strongest amenities. And one of the problems we've had in the past is the connections between the great trail systems and the outdoors around us, and trying to connect them to town so that you can have kind of some kind of head locations to take off. And that's why we bought the Tanner Park recently, and we're working on some trails that will take off to that and get into a pretty extensive trail system. So we're trying to make that more robust. People move here for that. It follows our brand. We want to be able to get people out in the outdoors more quickly and to be able to maybe host some competitive events that would be headquartered here, because we have access to those things. So that study is going, and we'll bring that to you before we go to council. We also have a government facilities mitigation fee, so that we can take a little bit of funding from each incremental growth we have, whether it's commercial or residential. We are building a new city hall. We did build the public works facility, and over time there will be need for probably a new senior center. They're working on an affordable housing project that might occur in that area. So there are some other needs as we grow. We don't have a youth center. We don't have a place for the kids to recreate. So we're looking at some of those in the future, and that will help fund it. We're also doing an economic profile and leakage study from a local consulting firm that's done quite a bit of that. And the reason for that is to give you and the council a good picture of what is our economic profile and where are the opportunities with all of the new growth and the additional buying power that's coming into the city. Where are we leaking our money? Where, if we could provide that marketing information to new businesses that could come into town, what businesses could survive well here with the new population and buying power for services we don't have now that we could locate here? And I've been very active as a developer in ICSC, which is the International Shopping Center Conference, and that's where the deals are made. And so I hope that once we get that information, we can go and set up a booth along with some interested brokers who are trying to help us and market our community a little more effectively and get some more services here. You may or may not know, but about 78% of the city resources come from commercial development. So we have some other initiatives to try to bring the commercial development to the forefront and make things happen. We held just this week our first outreach of the kind of a business forum with members of the community. We had a great, the gentleman in the audience was there. We had a great, I think we had a great turnout. I got some real positive feedback. And the objective of that is to try to foster a better partnership with the business community, and also to change the reputation we have, because we have a business unfriendly reputation, and we don't like that. We think it should change. So there are a lot of dynamics involved in that, and there are a lot of initiatives that we're going to be entering into to try to make it easier. We've done some things in the downtown by lowering fees. We may offer some equal incentives to folks in the business community who are either trying to expand their businesses, bring new businesses in, and we want to plan for success here. And so whatever it takes, we're going to bring initiatives to the council. We've been talking to them about it, and they are really excited about it. And we didn't have that attitude before. So I think we're going to do some great things with that. At their next meeting, at the first meeting, it was kind of a meet and greet and tell them what we're doing in the economic development area. And we invited the downtown merchants as well as all the other folks in the area. We probably had about 35 people, 40. And we even had a representative from the casino coming. We have a lot of businesses that are dependent on us that want to see what's going on. So we're going to meet monthly. It's kind of a little breakfast meeting, and we're trying to give them information from the city and fill in, you know, things they want to know about. The next topic they were interested in is what is the sewer and water capacity picture from the Public Works Director, and that will be our next topic. We meet at Umpqua Bank third Thursday of the month at 7:30, so if any of you are interested in sticking your nose in and getting some of our good bakery goods. You can come on in and take it in. And so that's an initiative that just because of one of our community and economic development meetings that a number of the members of the business community came in to talk to us about over the permitted uses and over the contemplated zoning changes. And they made a huge impression on two of our council members. And I offered at that meeting to hold this outreach, and it was very successful, and we're going to do it monthly. And I'm hoping that we get a much better relationship going between the business community and the city. Meadowbrook Farms has a number of things going on, and Mike has taken that under his wing. They're trying to get funds for trails, for improvements to the building there so they can have greater events, and really actively trying to grow that resource in the community. And we also have a partnership with the Mountains to Greenway people who are doing some trails in that area and have offered to help us with some of our blackberry mitigation and tree planting and reforestation in the area. So that's kind of cool. In addition to that, if you're interested in the permitted use and zoning map revisions, Jamie is heading that up. So if you have questions on that, she's the one to talk to. Cottage regulations, Mike just finished that. Jesse's picking up the rezoning of those areas that already have other uses in it, and so why zone them for cottage? So we're going to go ahead and make those changes to conform to what the existing uses are. We have landscape ordinance revisions that you've seen. Mike's heading that up. A grading and clearing tree regulations, that's Jamie's bailiwick. So if you have questions in those areas, just get a hold of those planners. We also have an initiative that was just started today by Lynn, and we've all been having trouble moving from office to office in our building because of the massive number of rolls of paper and reports and all that sort of thing. So we're going paperless. And we had our first going paperless meeting today. We're going to team up with the city of Bonnie Lake that did it and did it very well. And they made a nice presentation at the last Washington Planning Association meeting. I took that in and so did Jamie, and we're going to take them up on their invitation to go up and tour their facility, see what software they use, how they make the transition, how's it working, you know, let's learn from your mistakes. So we're going to try to go 100% paperless in the next year, and by the time we get into the new city hall. One thing I didn't put on the list that I'll let you know, we are building the new city hall. If you go down North Bend Way, you'll see it. I'm construction managing it because I've done about 2 million feet of retail, and why should we spend $125,000, $150,000 if we can do it in-house? Tom Moore, our deputy public works director, is managing all the site work. We have a great contractor. They're hoping to put a roof on in October, so they're churning and burning out there. So we're going to have a great facility. We hope to get everybody under one roof, have more of a one-stop center for the public, and present a better face and have a little better technology at our fingertips. So that's going on right now. The tenant trailhead parks and their grantsmanship that goes on with all of the trails, if you're interested in any of the park and trail information, Lynn's the person to talk to. Mike is also very involved in the park work. He has some good background and does some great landscape review for us. He's been involved in trying to order and get the new playground equipment at E.J. Roberts Park, and so he's really taken the lead in some of those areas. So I want to give you a little bit of rundown, because we meet and we do things, but I've never kind of said, here's what we're all doing. And when I got here, we had such a huge workload that we had this list of about two pages of special projects, most of which were ordinance revisions, and we just didn't have a good plan how to get through it. So we put them on a list, we prioritized them, and I said, look, let's take these commissions and committees that we staff, let's separate the labor, and anything you want to put on a commission or a committee agenda goes through the staff member in charge, and it's worked really well, and these guys have really run with it, so that's really helped us a lot. So I wanted to at least let you know who does what to who, and kind of some things that we're doing right now so that you get kind of a lay of the land, and it's good for the commissioners that have been here, and it's good for the new guys and gals. Yes, sir.
David, you told me something earlier on in your presentation that I wasn't aware of. There's the subcommittee that the council members occupy. Does that serve as a sieve between our votes and the city council?
It sure does. Yeah, it does. Because what they do is they'll take, like say for instance, you send a tree ordinance up. It'll go through the CED committee, which is a subcommittee of council. And if they have issues, they may send it back. If they have issues, they may ask for some changes. And then it goes up to the council. What I'm hoping to do is to improve that communication with the council by every time we go to them and we make a big, clear statement about this is the Planning Commission recommendation. So we're being very clear about that.
It's not very clear to me, though, that those recommendations do come back to us and it just goes forward.
Well, there are some that do, and we plan to have more of that in the future. For instance, once we, in the permitted uses, when we went through this vetting that brought the business community in, one of the things we found is that the council was doing some things that were not holistic and not big picture, and they were more based upon the appearance of uses than whether the uses belonged in one place or not, or whether we should even allow them. And so I said, you know, we can take care of the aesthetics. What I want you to focus on is the uses. So instead of talking about looking at these complicated tables and talking about uses, we sat down and we put together a series of objectives, real simple one, enrich the community's wealth, help with the fiscal health of the city. Another was to provide additional services and retail opportunities to the community. So we went down these objectives, and when we got done with them, when you look at the decision on land uses, it's pretty clear what the answer ought to be, rather than I don't like that or I don't like the way this looks or these kind of knee-jerk things that we were getting that really didn't reflect well when the business community came in and said, hey, we don't like this. So we said, let's operate from the standpoint of what the most positive values are for our community that we serve, and let's think about that when we think about the uses, not whether we personally like it or not. And so I think we're going to get a totally different reaction because of this community's involvement and because the focus is back on what it should have been on. So we're looking at the objectives, and that's our filter now. And I'd like to bring that list to you and bring back the results of what they recommended to you so that you see where they're sitting today. What is their position today? Because that whole process really started to go south on us, and we were able to bring it back. So that's a good example of how those committees, when it got to the CED committee, there were some people who had come to your meetings that just didn't want this to go on in the way it was going. So they came to the CED committee, and we had, 10 or 12 business people in that meeting, and they all reacted in a way that the two members of that committee, Martin and Trevor, said, this is the best public meeting we've had since we've been on the council. Let's listen to these guys and let's do this differently. And directed us to go back and take a look at it with more of an eye toward how, because I told them, if you're really interested in the aesthetics, we'll do a form-based code strip down North Bend Way. I really don't care what the uses are as long as it presents itself well to the community, because those uses are going to be driven by the market anyway. And then put the back of the house back there and make the front look good, make the front face look good. And, you know, we had one big debate over a car wash. And I said, look, you can make a car wash look like a restaurant if you want to. There's all kinds of things you could do. People have to wait while they're waiting for the thing to be done. You could put some umbrellas in the seating area. You could have coffee. You know, there's all kinds of things you could do. So you don't think of the use in terms of the physical appearance, because we can control that. So they're much more looking at the uses and letting us deal with the aesthetics. By the way, we do have, as a consultant that we use quite often, a very good design architect that lives near the community. Very surprised to find out after I bought my house, he's my next door neighbor, but he's done some great work for us. As a matter of fact, we had recently had this county loop facility that takes their sludge and takes it to Eastern Washington. They bring their trucks back here and they want to service them. And they brought us in an industrial nightmare of a building. And we told them that it didn't meet our design standards. And they tried to tell us, well, you're another government agency. You should be working with us. And every angle they could get at. And we said, no, you should be building an exemplary facility here. A, we don't need more trucks. B, you're taking one of our main pieces of property off the tax rolls. So what's the benefit to us? So we said the aesthetics are very important. They came back with a real nice redesign. And we thought we'd have to get Leroy involved, the architect involved, but we were able to persuade them, let's say, to come in with a good building. So we're really concentrated on urban design for what we have built here. So I think you're going to see a lot of nicer looking buildings as the new buildings come in. Mr. Garcia is working on a building right down on Park Street, and the coffee place and his pizza place will be in a very attractive building with great views of Mount Si. And it's going to really help that corner. So we have some great things going on in that area. But these the committees, I think they function very well. I do think there's a problem in getting positive feedback back to the commission and improving the communication between the two. And I've made that clear to the mayor and to the council. And I think you're going to, particularly with the membership and going through this recruitment and interviewing new commissioners, I think there's a greater awareness of the importance of the commission, and I hope that is going to improve.
Well, like, as a commissioner, one, thank you for that presentation.
Yeah.
I am glad, particularly, that the council members' subcommittee are aware of our value, because I'm fed up with the end run they play with us. I'm tired of it.
Well, I think the overall dynamics that are happening now, I think, are bringing the community together on some issues, because a lot of council people have felt incredible pressure from anti-growth folks, and we haven't had other people at the table. And the best decisions in the world are the decisions where everybody's at the table, because then you get point, counterpoint, and people sharpen their discussion, and they deal with things being influenced by the other parties, and you get more consensus of a much more elevated level in the discussion. And that's happening now. I see that happening now. And thanks to the business community and the environmental people that are active, that they care enough about the community that they're all showing up now. So that's a good thing. So that was just kind of the overview I wanted to give you before we get on the regular agenda. But I thought, particularly with new commissioners here, it's a good thing to just kind of, this is kind of how we do it. And these are the important programs that are going on now here, some of the challenges we're seeing, and some of the talented folks that are helping us through it. So,
yeah, thank you, David. I'll just second what Dick had said. As the new commissioners start working on things, will be, you know, like they say, deliberation and recommendation. That can take multiple meetings. And so I think doing a better job, other than us going to these CED meetings and then going to the city council meetings, we don't know. It doesn't come back to us what happens mm-hmm. and what tweaks occur. And I realize that maybe it's not easy to do, because to go back and then summarize and then look at what we did and what they did, it's probably a lot of work. But I guess just as a commissioner, it's difficult, because we don't know. And it's not like we wouldn't necessarily be okay with some of the tweaks. Maybe yeah. they're for the better, but we don't even know what they are. And to go figure that out, I mean, for you or for us, is probably difficult. So, I mean,
we do minutes of those meetings, and I'll commit to you now, and I think we should do this.
There's minutes.
Perhaps put those in your packet and get a little discussion going. Maybe leave a part of the meeting for you to comment, and there may be something that from those minutes you say, hey, this really wasn't where we were going, or what was the genesis of this particular initiative or whatever. And we can kind of fill you in at that point. The communication has to get better. So maybe one way to do it is put those minutes in your packet. If anything tweets you, or if you just want to ask us, hey, how'd it go at the meeting? We're happy to do that and report back. You know, we want you to work better. I think the one thing that will really help us to be a better staff is to kind of not forget about what was done in the past, build on it, but think out of the box. And we're trying to do a lot of things that are a little bit out of the box. Just so if we got in bad habits before, we're going to break those and give you better feedback. And we're also giving that feedback to the council. I mean, if you guys, Dick, you've been very vocal. If there are some areas in which we think you're not being heard, then we'll say things to them in their meetings. And we'll give them, pretty much a strong clue that, you know, either something isn't going right or you felt very strongly about something. And when we do present to the subcommittees, if there's an issue that might be controversial, or it might be, like, for instance, this new tree ordinance is quite different in the concept of how we're looking at tree cover versus just the significant trees. And you receive that very well, and I've never seen as elevated a discussion from the standpoint of professionals in horticulture, forestry, arborist as we had in that meeting. We had a park commissioner that was very well-versed. You're well-versed. So we really had some good input, and we had our city arborists that were on contract here, and he was involved. So we had a very elevated discussion there. So when we bring that kind of input to the council, and they're talking about things, we can, with great authority, say that was really heavily vetted, and we had professionals, at least three or four in the meeting, that advised us, and that's why we went this direction. So when we have those kinds of meetings where we really have some meat on the bone, we can tell them that, you know, we had professionals looking at it, and this is these are the whys and wherefores of their decisions. And that helped quite a bit to have that group and the kind of discussion that you had.
If you don't mind, you know, my first, you know, rookie question. I'm making an assumption here, but I'm assuming that once we make our recommendation and it goes to council subcommittee, it's nice to know it came back, but we really don't have any, it doesn't come back to us, correct, to make any changes?
It goes, the only reason it would come back is if they found something egregious or something they really wanted to see changed, they would send it back to the commission with their comments as to what did they find that was either a problem or what direction would they like you to explore. And you're going to see more of that, I think, because we're in some dicey issues with zoning, designations on property, with use listings in the code. And trees are a huge issue here. So there's some like that where they may kick it back and say, well, you said this, but we'd like you to look at that. So you're going to see a little bit more of that. And part of this process of trying to improve communication, they're starting to kind of warm up to, well, should this go back? They've never asked those questions before. So I see a little bit better awareness of what the roles are.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if it's not coming back, if it's not being sent back to us, I kind of agree that even just a summary sheet with some comments that says, you know, your recommendation went this way, here's where they changed it, just a comment showing why that happened. Mm-hmm. That'd be really handy to see, you know, get an understanding of
I think for expediency, what we're going to try to do first is bring you the minutes and then give you a little briefing.
Yeah.
If you want something that'll work better than that, we're certainly willing to look at it. And but we're trying to capture pretty well. Like, people take pretty good notes at those minutes at meetings, and it really gives you the flavor of the high spots in the road. So.
Yeah, briefing would be great. Yeah.
Do you make changes, like there's a proposed ordinance that we send to the committee? Do you then do any of the committee changes and track changes?
Yes.
So that's
another. And we could do that as well.
So not that we necessarily need that for every item, but at least if we know it's available and we can ask
sure.
for it.
If you hit something that's of great interest to the commission, you really want to know what do they do, we could certainly provide that to you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, just kind of awareness of it. I mean, there's certain things that they have put right through.
Yeah.
The wireless thing, there was something on lighting.
Yeah.
That they went right through. I happened to look,
right.
And there was some discussion over the Park Street kind of bike lanes. You know, just kind of read that in passing. But those are kinds of things that you would never know unless you actually go to city council meetings.
Those are sort of things that we don't have to have come back.
It's kind of just like so you know what the code is, right? What is it? Because we spend a lot of time on this. I mean, we craft it. We do a pretty good job.
Yes.
To toot our own horns here, you know. So
and you're
going to
have some public work standards that are being adopted, and there's some of those that relate to planning issues, whether it's, you know, the street widths, where are you going to put bike lanes, or are you going to, are they separated, are they on street, things like that. Are you going to use a parkway strip separated from the sidewalk, or is it a curb sidewalk? Things like that. We're going to bring all that back to you so you'll see it. And if there's, if we're going to just continue with the standards we have, you're going to know what they are. If we're going to create new ones, you'll know that. We've had a lot of talk about some neighborhoods wanting a very rural feel and perhaps looking at rolled curbs as an opportunity. And because you've got to direct your drainage, but it's not a raised curb that really makes it formal and makes it look more like an urban setting. So there's some things like that that we're contemplating that will come back to you, and you'll be able to comment on them. But the public work standards are on the horizon to come back. So if you want to go ahead with your agenda, I think we'll be the approval and on to the minutes. And I would suggest that we put on your next agenda the election of the vice chair, and we'll do that so that you, the rules of the game are if something isn't on the agenda, you can't take action on it. Okay. So we'll bring that one to you because that's our oversight, and we'll make sure we pick that one up.
All right, well, let's approve tonight's agenda. Do I have a motion?
Sure. I move to accept the agenda.
All right, do I have a second?
A second.
All right. Any comments or changes? All right, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right. All right. Motion carries. It's unanimous. And now the approval of last meeting's minutes. Do we need a quorum for that, or is that?
Yeah. You've got a quorum.
Yeah. As far as the people were at the, and most people were actually at the.
No,
meeting,
just for continuity's sake, I think if we just go ahead and make motion.
Just
and
get them right
and
there.
You've got. Well, you even have. You have some commissioners that were. That we're here.
Not commissioner at the
even
time,
though they
but
weren't
here.
Right.
Yeah, so,
right.
That, yeah.
Right.
So we'll come on.
Yeah.
All right. Approval of last meeting's minutes, May 10th.
Sure. I vote the minutes be accepted as amended.
All right.
I got a Burlington's name is probably the record. Appreciate that.
Okay. Yeah. A little change there. Okay. So we have a motion. We have a second.
Second.
All right. We got a second. Comments or changes? All those in favor say aye.
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 I want to just ask a question on that. You said as amended. Is there still an incorrect spelling in there?
No. It was correct. It's the minutes as presented last week were amended.
Okay. All right. No opposed. So motion carries. It's unanimous. I had a question before we go on. The public comment on non-agenda items. Why is the public not able to comment on things on the agenda?
Well, what we generally do, just kind of following Robert's rules of order and the way that people do these in municipalities, people come to these meetings quite often because they want to be informed about what's going on, but they may have another issue that they want the commission to relate to, so it opens the floor to that.
For sure.
Yeah. If you have a public hearing, and it's up to the chair's discretion, if it's not a public hearing, yeah. If you bring up an item on the agenda, you want the discussion to occur with the item. As you deliberate first, and then you open it up to the public if you choose. Some of these will be for public hearing. Some of them aren't, but it's at your pleasure.
Yeah.
People are here and want to speak, we usually just go ahead and let them do it. And so, really, it's just an organizational tool to keep the comments under the discussion and in the proper location so that you can have your deliberation and then receive that and continue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, there's just not, and we've been casual here.
Yeah.
As you've said, you know, if someone wanted to comment on the landscape regulations or the zoning map, but it's
right.
Just not really formalized that that is okay.
Yeah, it's a good idea, I think, for the chair. If people are interested, for the chair to, you know, just look at the commission.
For me, I guess I'm a big picture guy, so
yeah.
For me, I would almost, I'm not saying this needs to change, but I would have public comment on agenda or non-agenda items, and then we can get it out there, and so we know.
Well, I think the reason for it is to allow people who come to tell you about something, so they don't have to wait till it comes up. They can do it at the beginning of the meeting. If they're not interested in the rest of the meeting, they can leave, and they can bring up those things that aren't on the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason that we separate that is that when you get under the deliberation itself, they're a part of the total conversation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, here we are at public comment on non-agenda items. Does anyone have any non-agenda topics?
Michael Thomas, 1231 La Forest Drive, SE. Yes, welcome new commissioners, and you'll find that I comment fairly frequently either here or city council, and I'm actually quite highly opinionated about trees, landscaping, density, infrastructure. I want to bring up a couple things. One was something actually very simple. One, we need an update of the city's website that lists the planning commissioners and Exploder. I had reached out to Tom Meager because I actually wanted to reach out about one of the items that is on the agenda tonight, and I wanted to make a comment about it. So it's important that we actually have like an updated email contact list as well as an Exploder like planning commission at northbendw.gov. So that goes to all of you so we don't have to know really who you are or whatever. So it did impact actually making comment for tonight's meeting. So I think let's try to get that updated as quickly as possible so the public knows who's on the commission. I didn't know who was left. So, second thing is, and I appreciate David's comments around some of the tree preservation code. And in fact, one of the things I'd like to hear about is really where, maybe not here, but where is our tree preservation code, which deals with enhanced canopy cover, preservation of significant trees, because this is such a sore point in town for us. You know, as we see the clear cuts that happen in the traffic circle, as well as we saw as what happened like at the cottages in North Bend, we're seeing total clear cuts within the interiors of developments. And as you think about it, you know, a little bit, and I'll reserve my comments for the landscaping code is around the perimeters of properties or streets is also important. So you have to view these two things together as to holistically, how do we keep the trees? You know, I live along Cedar Falls Way. I live in the forest, so that's adjacent to Cedar Falls. I think we're not doing enough actually to protect Cedar Falls Way. We hear a lot about North Bend Way. I see problems with street widths that were adopted in city council. In fact, the standards were flipped between north and south, and it's still broken in the city code. But I really feel that if we don't act to adopt better standards for Cedar Falls Way and similar streets like SE 140th up by Wood River, we're going to lose all those trees. And those are really heavily treed wooded areas that people would like to see preserved. It's not just about trails along North Bend Way. We also need to think about preserving some of our more wooded trails and more wood streets. That's a lot of value to our citizens, the property values. People walk along those roads. Neighborhoods have gone to great lengths like La Forest. Even Cedar Falls has huge buffers like Cedar La Forest. Our neighborhood protects all vegetation within 50 feet of the road, not just a single tree or two. So we have CCRs in our covenants in our property that do that. There's great examples of properties near us. Like there's a new one that went in right next to La Forest that was a home where they didn't just cookie cutter. They actually built the home around the trees. Trees are not just for the convenience bulldozing for the developer. What can we do to really keep more of our trees that are existing, not just clear cut because it's convenient for utilities? And that was something that I thought the tree preservation code would really do. And I'm disturbed that we don't see that yet. I'm worried that we're going to get new development being grandfathered in under the old code, which has really been problematic. So I would urge Planning Commission and City Council really to act with some speed to adopt new tree preservation codes, adopt higher density of trees even in the landscaping code. And that's about all I have to say, but I wouldn't mind one comment around the landscaping code that was quite specific. So I just got to ask your leave to comment when that time comes up.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Joe Eddings, 43438 Southeast Brooklyn Way. I'm here talking about hats earlier. I didn't quite hear the whole thing, but I wear two hats. By the way, welcome to the commissioners and for your service. Appreciate that. And David, you're doing a great job, by the way. That meeting we had with business owners the other day was far exceeded my expectations. And your presentation was commendable. It was spot on, so I appreciate that. I wish I could have stayed. I thought it was at 7 o'clock, so I had a meeting preset at 8, so I left early, which I was too bad. I'm a licensed real estate broker in town, so I deal a lot with property owners who have properties that they've held for a long time or bought as investment for a purpose, for a higher and better use to develop or hold on investments. And I deal with people who have properties that they've been in their family for 50 years, and now it's time for them to do some of the property. So I'm getting really involved just because I've been hearing some things that have been going on, and so it's time for me to get back in. I did a long time ago down City Suquamish. I developed a piece of property down there, so I kind of slowed down and just not get involved anymore. But I'm right back into it again. I think if you want things to happen, I think we do have to get a voice. So I've been talking to a lot of the business owners and property owners locally, and so it's good to see that they're finally response and people are listening. It is time for us to come up and start speaking. So I'm here to, one, A, help my clients be better informed. It it's nice when people talk about things. And you know, what I've realized recently is well, when I was at the meeting, and da-da-da-da is happening. Well, this is going on. So it's nice for me to be able to relay what's going on here to the public, or the property owner. So that's a huge plus for me. It really is exciting for me. So I kind of got re-energized. So I like what's happening now, but I think there's still a lot of work to do. Okay, that hat's off. The other hat's on. I'm also a business owner. And also, not here in North Bend yet, but I'm trying to. And I haven't quite pulled the trigger yet because I don't think the way things are set up now, it's not very friendly. It's not, it doesn't make sense. Cost prohibited, restrictions, obligations. So I've really put on a hold on that because it's a huge investment. And I don't have Connor Holm pockets. I don't have Polygon pockets. We're just a small guy trying to work hard and do something. So, and that's the other reason why I'm getting involved wearing these other hats is I'm really concerned because I really want to invest money here and build a really successful business and support the community. I'm born and raised here. I supported the high school with all my kids going through to Mount Sinai and charity fundraisers and everything. And I want to continue to do that. But I've been hesitant. And you know, and David mentioned earlier that City of North Bend has had a kind of a bad reputation as far as working with and getting things done. It's not just locally here. I'm here in the South Side. Other professionals who do commercial real estate or other real estate outside the area. We're talking Seattle area, Bellevue. Everybody goes, oh, yeah, I heard about North Bend. So I'm seeing some change, and it's promising. So I'm here to talk about some things. And one aspect, I know we're talking, Mike, you're kind of in charge of this landscaping ordinance in here that you're changing some things. I own a car wash down Snoqualmie, and I want to put a new high-tech, super modern-looking building up here in North Bend on a piece of property. So I've been working with, put my dock in over 2 years ago. It's EP1 zoning. And so I put a dock in to looking at the uses and codes. And there's neighborhood business, there's EP1, EP2, and I'm looking at, and I saw where my personal, what I want to do is allowed in the neighborhood business to me. So I look at that, and I go, I do a lot of commercial real estate stuff, I go, God, that doesn't make sense. I looked at other ordinances around Bellevue, Issaquah, Renton, and there's nowhere, anywhere, as anybody has a mixed-use residential commercial allows for a car wash. Because who wants to have that next to an apartment building? Or a house, or a duplex, or fourplex, like that. So, and I got looking at the uses for EP1, and I go, wow, that really makes sense. It's a heavier use, not really residential going. And I go, wow, that's a really good fit. So I've been working on this for 2 years. My doc has been in trying to get this amended. A, leave it North Bend, NB zone, that's fine, but that really should be taken out, and I think this really should be. Now, again, this will be selfish about me here, about my property and what I want to do, but I think that makes really good sense. So I've been fighting that for 2 years. So now I'm going to get a little more involved and just see if we can get along and start getting these uses like you talked about and these different zones and everything out there so it's laid out. And back to Mike about the landscaping thing is in EP1, I have a 37,000 square feet. And I started looking, one reason why I'm going, I don't want to do this. I can't. You know, I have a 20-foot landscaping inside my property. You know, if you look at commercial real estate, it's all price per square foot. And guess what? It's going through the ceiling. But now I'm looking at it going, wow, I'm going to lose a third of my property. You know, I got 20,000, 15,000 square feet of landscaping. I have a 37,000 square foot. I do 20-foot buffer all the way around. I know you can build on the property line, but the rest of it has to be a landscape. That's a lot of landscaping. That's very prohibitive. That's very expensive. And it eliminates what I can do with that property. So I'm glad to hear, Mike, that you guys are working on changing that and bringing it down. Is that correct?
That's correct. We'll get into that.
And you got about one more minute.
Almost done. Okay.
Yep.
So anyway, I just want just to be more business friendly. That's what we're talking about, you know. So that would be encouraging for me to go ahead and start implementing, spending that money, the engineering, the civil work, and that kind of stuff, and all the tax fees I got to pay, is try to get that helpful. Because I pay Issaquah $3,000 a month. Now my excise tax goes up. I mean, this is bringing money to the city. That's where you guys make your money. So if we can help that, make that friendly to that, yet do it tastefully, great. Don't mind landscaping, trees. I like trees, but as long as it works together, So that's why I'm here. So again, thank you guys for your time.
Thank you for comments. All right, so now we're on to Planning Commission deliberation and possible recommendation.
I have extra packets if anybody would like to have one.
Amendments to North Bend Municipal Code, Chapter 18.18 Landscape Regulations.
All right, so this was introduced at the last Planning Commission meeting, and a number of you were able to be there before becoming formal Planning Commissioners. But I'll just give a quick summary of what the amendments are again. So this is one that didn't have a glaring issue that we needed to resolve, but just over the course of time of implementing our landscape regulations, as we reviewed development proposals, we saw a number of things that kind of emerged over and over, similar comments and similar problems. If you see a comment for one particular development, it's a one-off situation and not generally a problem. But a lot of these had come back over and over, and so we had listed them over time as things to come back to address, and this was just a good time to capture that following the amendments that we'd done with the tree regulations, to follow that up with some consulting service with our landscape architect consultant and arborist as well. One of the things that we wanted to do was to address soil preparation. Soil preparation is really needed, especially as you go east of town here, or to the east end of town where the soils are very rocky and porous, so that's good for drainage, but it's not necessarily good for growing plants. Also dealing with some issues that we've had with wildlife, with the size of ground cover, some of our ground cover with 4-inch pots, the elk just tend to chomp and pull out, or they become desiccated over time and dry up and die. And then list of prohibited species for landscaping. We have a number of landscape species that are available in nurseries that developers will sometimes go to that are not really the best selection for within the context of the natural environment that we have around us that can spread into the forest lands. Other things with single-family homes constructed outside of short flats, we've got provisions in there that talk about maintenance bonding requirements that technically it would apply, but don't really make sense in the context of a single-family home where the homeowner's interest is to maintain their own landscaping over time. And then, as Joe mentioned, there were some situations with our landscape buffers, particularly within the industrial zone, that we found with a number of different applications over time that they were excessive, 20 feet where it's buffering to adjacent industrial. So that you'd have 20 feet plus 20 feet on the adjacent property, 40 feet of landscaping between what essentially are compatible uses. So we felt that that was excessive. Other things were our street tree list had become out of date over time, recommending a number of trees that were prone to disease or other problems. And then finally, our fence regulations that we had in the code were very, very confusing and inadequate, so we've updated that. Just provided a lot more clarity overall to the regulations. Since the time of your last meeting, the Planning Commission provided a lot of comments at the last meeting, and I wanted to just touch on some of those amendments before we get into this discussion. You'll find we've addressed the applicability of the regulations, clarifying that we're not talking about landscaping by homeowners themselves, but this is applicable to new development. Other things that were addressed were the native content increasing to 60% requirement for new development. I want to come back to that during the discussion. Jim had mentioned concern about, Dick had mentioned concern about visibility to signs and other key features of the site, so we've added some language to provide flexibility for maintaining that kind of visibility in landscape buffers. Add some language about stability of the sidewalks and making sure that soil amendments aren't compromising that stability over time. And then also increasing the duration of the landscape maintenance bond period from 2 years to 3 years to make sure that we're having a good plant establishment over time. And then correlating our irrigation requirements from 2 years to 3 years to match that. So, I wanted to turn it back to you guys to open the discussion.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I think we can go through those the city's changes on our behalf in a little more detail. I guess with the new commissioners, does anyone, do any of you have any changes that you'd like to make? I guess it's kind of a yes or no, and then we can kind of go through those, or we can just kind of review as a whole if you don't.
I don't have any changes.
Okay. Gary?
No changes. It did have some questions that were more okay. Like process or context changes, so okay. If you want to hold those till later, that's fine.
Yeah, you can just, do you have some changes?
Yeah, I have some okay. questions and changes I'd like to suggest for the TLA board okay. at the end. So.
I'd say let's just start with your questions, and then we can go into what we kind of, review what we did last meeting is kind of what it would be. So this would be new things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Again, like I mentioned, introducing myself on these questions, you're going to be rookie.
No problem. This is the time to do it.
I appreciate it. And if after asking these questions, if you think, particularly you, Mike, or David, or Jesse, if you think these are the kind of questions that would be more helpful, like offline, up front, then I'll kind of change the approach. So, my first question was actually one that just popped up on the page one of your summary. And when you were talking, it's the third from the bottom board about the landscape buffer requirements in the perimeter. I was just wondering if maybe not specifically to Mr. Eddings' project no. or comment, but is that the category of his comment? Is that what that's kind of getting at, is looking at those kind of requirements and their applicability? Is just
yeah.
what that topic is?
That is, yes. Okay. So adjacent to property boundaries,
okay.
our code requires a landscape buffer. And that landscape buffer, the primary purpose of that is to provide compatibility between uses.
Okay.
So that you're buffering, for example, if you have a single family home and you've got a commercial business that moves in next door, you want to have a little bit of screening. So that buffer okay. is providing that screening. But the idea with the amendments is that when you've got two compatible uses within the same zone, you don't necessarily need to have a substantial buffer. So a 20-foot buffer adjacent to another 20-foot buffer for another industrial use would probably be excessive. And we've heard that comment over and over a number of applications over
time. So not wanting to get into a lot of into a specific project or example, does any of the proposed changes change?
It does, yeah. Okay. So if you look at page 21, that's our required landscaping for interior lot lines and transition areas. And actually it starts on page 20 there.
And that's where the 20
is. Yeah, so you'll see on our industrial employment park 1, where it's abutting industrial, it's changing from a 15 to a 10-foot buffer. And then abutting parks and open space, changing from a 20-foot to a 10-foot buffer. And we have similar reductions for commercial and industrial park 2. And then also non-residential use in a single-family zone abutting parks and open space.
Okay, got it. I have a question on page 2 regarding environmental impacts. I was curious if the environmental impacts include noise or air quality, if those are within the scope of consideration for environmental impacts.
They could be, yeah. So this is these criteria are just things that we need to consider as reviewing criteria for the Planning Commission.
Okay. Okay. And then a question on comment in section 2 there on the same page on the economic impacts, somewhere kind of in the middle. There's a comment about existing standards considered excessive to the level of impact. And I was just wondering from a process standpoint, I mean, how do you evaluate that, or how do you determine that?
The level of impact?
Yeah.
So it always comes back to compatibility of uses. Okay. So if one single family home next to another single family home are considered fully compatible uses, you don't typically have a thick landscape buffer between your house and your neighbor's house. You've got conventional landscaping that you have throughout a yard, but it's not intended generally as a wall. And a landscape buffer is more intended as a true screen.
So
So it's truly like a case-by-case evaluation on impacts?
For the most part.
You kind of looked at some historical projects and what the current regulations have.
Yeah, we have had a number of examples that have come through the office that the application of the current landscape standards has been a pretty significant burden for the property owner.
Okay. And so that's kind of part of the spirit to some of these changes.
Okay.
Yeah, again, most of my questions were really about the process and context and understanding how some of these objectives or criteria are applied.
Did you have anything in the chapter, the landscaping regulations?
No, I didn't have anything really specifically there. I was kind of looking at the body of the text of my questions to put what's actually being recommended into perspective.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah.
James.
Okay. I kind of brought this up two weeks ago now about the TLA concerns. And I wanted to, maybe I'm missing something, you know, obviously I'm new, but,
What page are you on?
Yeah, so sure. I made some edits, so maybe my page numbers are a little wrong, but I'm on 15. That's where the transitional landscape area starts. So in doing this, and I had, again, I brought this up as a public comment and you addressed it a little bit, but I wanted to get a little more better understanding. I asked about the total effect of the land, and you have in here, as item 2 of the TLA section, A2, where the TLA affects more than 20% of the total gross area of any parcel, the TLA may be reduced such that not more than 20% of the total gross area of the parcel is affected. I think that should affect all buffers. All buffers should account for 20%. Not just the TLA. So, in thinking about some of the lots along the where the TLA is affecting, especially in the EP1 and EP2 of the east side of town, we do have some areas of skinny lots that run parallel with the road where the TLA is affecting quite a bit of land. That item 2 reduces the TLA to 20%, but even in that case, your other buffers around the lot itself create a postage stamp idea to these smaller lots. I was able to take a look at a couple of examples. I'll quickly brief them, for instance, the Cascade Diesel lot, where the Cascade Diesel is now on over there, the TLA there would be 40 feet, which accounts for 7% of the lot. That's, you know, very skinny running into the lot. But what you look at when you look at the total unusable land with these setbacks that are here, you have residential on two sides, the left or the west and northern side, and then EP1 on the east. When you look at the total setback and TLA, it actually works out to 32% of the lot. I think that when you take into account the other setbacks that we're imposing on these commercial buildings, mostly commercial lots, but also the changes you guys had to the cottage residential for the TLA, you'll see that the number gets pretty high when you bring in these other setbacks as well. And so I'm wondering if that could be better handled by, instead of the 20% reduction for just the TLA section, more like a 20% for the whole lot with all setbacks included. In the cottage residential side, there was a small lot on Cedar Falls zone cottage residential, has a 35-foot TLA, which ended up being 43% of the lot. So under these rules, it knocks down to 20%, right? That makes it a 16-foot TLA. But then when you include the rest of the setbacks around it, you're taking the setbacks are 39% of the lot in total, even with that reduction. I think that, you know, I think that's a bit much for what we're really looking for, and especially in that cottage residential side, it's surrounded by other cottage residential.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I really hear you, and I think that's a really good suggestion. The thought that I would have, I want the Planning Commission to think about is is the perimeter landscape buffers are, again, a tool for compatibility to provide that separation, that buffering. The TLA buffer itself is a quite a large buffer, and that's why that reduction was placed in there. So we maybe could add some language under the modifications to standards section. My concern would be reducing a perimeter landscape buffer in that context when you could have an adjacent property under that.
Exactly. You don't want a commercial to residential to get smaller than 10 feet. You want a buffer there and understand that. I don't know if maybe a language for smaller lots changes, right? Because a lot of these...
James, do you find, just as a matter of curiosity, do you find that these examples that you picked up, one of the problems that we have, particularly in our industrial areas, is that we have pre-existing uses that are non-conforming, that are single family. So you want to protect them, but on the other hand, you don't want to diminish the value of the property to the point where it can't be used. So do you find that most of the examples that you had are similar to that?
Yeah, so the smaller lots, and especially when, like you said, to commercial, Cascade is a perfect example. I picked that one specifically because I knew that had residential next to it. You're right, we don't want to lose that buffer, I just understand it. And when you talk about that, I don't know what you guys would call the lot, but the really big lot back there on that side of town, yeah, a 50-foot buffer is not a big deal for something that big, right? You still have a lot of land to use. I'm not saying that 50 feet's not a big buffer. I'm not a huge fan of that either. But in terms of, you know, having a lot more of your land still available to you, for sure. But we do have a lot of cases in the zones that this TLA affects, pretty small lots, and like I said, lots that TLA takes up quite a bit. And I understand the 20% reduction there, but my fear is that that reduction still doesn't help some of the smaller lots that would be affected a lot more, even outside of that.
Well, let's take a look at that, Mike, and see what we can do. I think one of the things that we struggle with a little bit is we want to protect the single family, but on the other hand, they are a non-conforming use. And you don't want to perpetuate non-conforming uses forever. So if they're located within an industrial zone, that kind of goes with the territory that things are going to change for you. So what we might do is in those areas where you have the real intent is to protect long-term uses and investment on property that's intended for the use.
Yeah, maybe that's the right approach then. Yes, we could allow that reduction for when the property is abutting an adjacent same zone use.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean... I kind of asked the question last time, too, about residential. It seems kind of funny to me to have a buffer between residential and residential. At the time, I was imagining two fences with 5 feet between them as a buffer, right, which obviously that's not the way it's written out. But, that same uses, I think that can be handled a little better.
Well, let's take a look at that and really follow the concept that in like-zoned areas, you can reduce the buffer and just see how we could do that to allow more usability. I think the concern really is between different zoned uses.
Sure.
I mean, one of the big issues that we've been trying to get to is actually, frankly, getting rid of some of these overlays that, for some crazy reason, have put residential right in the middle of our... it's spot zoning, quite frankly, right in the middle of our industrial areas, and that's just not good land use planning. And it really plays havoc with businesses trying to locate, and it plays havoc with people who locate there and say, why'd you do it? So if they're like zoned but different uses, perhaps we need to reduce the buffer because you don't have that same kind of protection in industrial land if you're located there. And the value of, over time, of that land is going to appreciate for the property owners, and a change will occur. So, we hear you.
So, another comment on item 3 of page 16. The 40-foot buffer for the TLA, you recognize three specific areas there. Southeast 140th as A. B, you say West North Bend Way for properties zoned EP1. Looking at the map, I couldn't find any properties that were zoned EP1 along North Bend Way. Now, they're along Ulm Way. Is that the ones that you're talking about there?
West North Bend Way?
Item B.
B
3B.
B3 there. So, yeah, that, I think that's intended for the properties that are long.
Oh, right.
Maybe we'll clarify that one.
Okay.
If that's the case.
And then same idea there, East North Benway, do you mean Southeast North Benway there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And lastly, in that same section, with the zoning changes that we're planning, we brought up for the last part of today's meeting, does this need to follow along with that, the cottage residential changes?
So what this is doing is just making reference to those regulations that exist within the cottage regulations.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So once you change the zoning, that doesn't pertain to that lot anymore because you're in a new zone.
Okay.
And I think the main issues that we reacted to, and the Planning Commission reacted to, when some of the public came in and they lived on the larger lots where cottages would come in, they didn't want that kind of density too close to where they were because it was incompatible.
Sure.
So we reacted.
I just had to know if this document would have to be changed again to follow along with any changes to the zoning that was proposed upcoming.
No, what we're looking at is just the zoning map.
Sure.
It's not actually changing the zoning regulations.
Okay.
Just where it is, the location of it.
Yes.
Are you done?
Yeah.
Okay. That's why.
I definitely said enough.
I didn't want to step over you there. I do agree with the point of dealing with nonconforming uses in a separate way. So right. Number one. But to your point where maybe there is a landscape buffer that might be a little bit too large for a piece of property, am I correct that on page 18, section, page 18, section 18.18.170 modification of standards could be used to reduce that buffer width.
It could, and I was thinking about that would be maybe the place to locate that language about if a reduction may be allowed in landscape buffers when such buffers occupy more than 20% of the overall area of the property for adjacent, or two adjacent properties within the same zoning district. So I might wordsmith that a little bit.
You just kind of cap the amount of land that could be used for buffers so that it doesn't exceed 20% of the lot.
I think if that comes back to us, which sounds like it will, it'd be good to have a specific example. It sounds like you've already done some work on that.
I would want to do a little bit better. Yeah. All I had was the Kinkany parcel viewer, but it's pretty easy.
Just the practical side of it,
Right.
Okay.
And we might want to consider the size of the property too, because if you've got a 10-acre property, maybe make it bigger, 20-acre property, and we're capping the amount of landscape buffer at 20%, that's very different than a 10,000 square foot property you're capping at 20%. So there might be more room for a larger buffer on the larger property. That's why I guess why I'm going with that.
And one of the issues that's been brought up to us by people and the landowners with buffers, particularly with relationship to industrial against industrial, a lot of folks say, why is there an industrial buffer at all between industrial property? And that's something I think we need to look at, and that deals with the public comment tonight about, I'm left with too large a percentage of my property being taken away, when in fact the buffer might be very effective against other uses, or there has to be a purpose behind that buffer.
Or along the street
right.
for aesthetic
right.
reasons.
Right. Some of providing those landscape transitional buffers too is also to preserve as you're looking across a landscape so that you're not just seeing asphalt and buildings.
Yeah.
They're also breaking up the landscape in kind of a long vision.
And what I wouldn't want to see is, you drive through like the Soto area of Seattle, and it's just like one warehouse after another, after another, after another, and there's no trees whatsoever in portions of it.
Right. Right.
I'm not sure that that's what we want.
They just
here.
Won't fit the character of the community.
I think there's a balance somewhere in there.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, I think view breaks.
Real quick. Am I allowed to occupy? I'm not, just tell me.
I think we can open that up in just a minute, and we can have those comments.
Another question related to the question.
Okay. I was just going to say I think that the buffers are what I think of the public's biggest concern with development right now. So having those view breaks is important to see the business, but I think if we can buffer areas like along North Bend Way or along Cedar Falls, or, you know, kind of have an opening to the developments, to the businesses, but not have it just a wipe out and then replant, then I think it'd be an easy win, you know, if we're concerned about the public's you know, perception mm-hmm. of the development we're doing. I think, you know, and as you've kind of mentioned stuff like that, you know, you can kind of change you talk about the development and the business look, but you can also do that with the buffer.
Well, then it becomes, I think, less important to emphasize buffers between industrial properties if the frontage along the road is effectively
true,
either landscaped or some natural landscaping is left along with the the addition. You really can't see anything behind
it.
Yeah,
it's like, well, so I don't know what's back there.
Why are we hitting people up with that? I get that.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think one of the things I'd like to really kind of weave in all of our discussions is a balance between aesthetics and economics, so that if we can allow people as part of this transition into being more business friendly to utilize their property more effectively, but to really make it look nice from the street and from views from offsite, then I think we're accomplishing two things. We're allowing people to really get good utility of the property, and as far as the face of the property goes to the public, it looks attractive.
Maybe you can help me out a little bit here, too, along the same lines. I didn't dive into the code, per se, enough to answer this, but with industrial, with EP1 and EP2, are we expecting storefront on those?
No.
Okay. So just in commercial, we're expecting storefront. Because that's where I would be a little concerned about a buffer in the front, is if you have a storefront and you have a lot of trees blocking, that's obviously that.
That's another clarification, is all of these buffers do not apply where there's buildings. So our intent is the building takes precedence. In a lot of cases, we require the building to be built up to the street.
Okay.
So in that case, the buffer doesn't shove the building back. The building occupies the buffer.
Sure.
And that's why you do lose some landscaping on the street frontage. But the reason for that is to try to create an attractive built frontage, and it does have to be landscaped. There's no doubt about that in any zone. But what you don't want is when you start moving the buildings back, people start putting trucks, parking, other storage, other things on the street frontage, which we don't want to see there. So if you move the buildings up and you have back of house in the back of the house and you landscape it well, then I think the end product that we get is going to be superior to something where you get all the parking out front, or you get trucks or storage or other things, and the buildings are set back. Because then you got to look at all the back of the house up front.
Sure.
I mean, I think one example of what I'm talking about is on Tanner Road, and it sounds like there's going to be a berm and a buffer will be left there. You know, and that could be planted as well. Mm-hmm. So there's one entrance into the development, mm-hmm. and then it's a massive 156-home development. You know, another way you could do that is to have driveway, 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 house. Mm-hmm. So you drive by and it's like, oh, there's a housing development. You know, so it's just a way of kind of screening it a little
right.
bit.
Right, and the standards that we use in residential areas where you're really trying to meet some of the needs that we heard from the public and that we're trying to do, you have a greater opportunity for leaving natural landscaped areas that really kind of hide what's going on behind it. But the nature of business is to be seen and to be, when people are trying to find out where you are and get in, that they can do that.
Sure.
And so you want to minimize curb cuts, but you want to have the storefront and the availability of the business as a face to the public visible. So it's a little different design challenge.
All right, let's open it up to public comment on this topic. Well, I mean, we can jump back, so we're not closing it to our deliberation.
Sorry, I want to take your time. I appreciate that. Is there anything in the order as far as like properties? And you got 10 feet, 10 feet, and they're like, and either property owners doesn't really care. I know you want to look nice, but what if there's solid fencing that's put down there? Would you get benefit of that for less of a buffer setback? Landscaping some like solid fencing for a buffer, are they considered?
Not in our regulations as they stand. I think one of the intents of the landscaping buffer is to soften, and a fence line might not soften. It maybe separates, but it doesn't soften the appearance.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if you've seen any of these new vinyl fencing out there. They actually make it for a tall green, make it a colored lawn or solid. It's a gray separator, but put them up, you can't even see them. They're really very attractive, and they last forever. That's a good separator between the properties. You know, that was just an idea.
Yeah, I think when we have light zone, particularly in the industrial zone, we should look at that and then see if you get an effective enough screen along the front. You can't really view what's going on in the back. Then it's really up to those property owners, and you know, if they want to do that because they have a good business purpose for doing it, I think it's great. But I think that we should be more concerned about the face in industrial areas rather than the buffers between. And a lot of it depends on the circumstances too, because we, for instance, when we had this facility coming that the county was putting in, they said, look, we've got trees all around it. You can't even see our storefront. Why should we make it look good? And our answer to that is, well, you may have them today, but we know how that goes. So we want to make sure that your front looks attractive. And we don't want to be varying standards between people similarly zoned, because then you're all over the map.
And the amendments to the landscape buffers that we provided between different properties was the starting point. So if the Planning Commission wants to suggest further reductions or other alterations, we certainly have all ears for that.
On that table one, is cottage residential not on there for a reason?
There are no, let me take a look at that with you. So we have no single family zones in that table.
Okay.
And the idea is a single family is generally considered a compatible use to any other use.
Okay.
So a business doesn't really care about being buffered from a single family home.
Okay.
But we have in there non-residential uses in single family zones. For example, churches are allowed throughout our residential zones.
Do you have something, Michael?
Yeah, actually, since I had a few questions, and it was only one. I look at 1818, zero rating, part section C under type 3, digital buffers on page 11. This was a concern I had around single light uses like cottage residential across from LDR and Cedar Falls Way is the exact example of this. And there might be some few others that are more industrial in town, like Wood River and SC 140th. It looked like to me that you were proposing that one tree for every 50 by 10 foot section would be preserved. One, it wasn't clear, like Cedar Falls Way has a 35 foot buffer, so does that mean 3.5 trees per 50 by 10 section? And in any case, I think that one tree for every 50-foot section is nowhere near the character of Cedar Falls Way or SC 140th.
So. This is not about preservation of trees. This is about required planting in buffers. And the amendment there was specifically because the way the current regulations read, you could do that because it just calls out a spacing within the buffer, regardless of how wide the buffer is. So the amendment is to say it's per every 10 feet of that buffer.
It wasn't clear, so like when I read that, it was like, wow, that's only one tree for every 10 by 50 section.
No, that's just the minimum, and that's as you're going through the buffer, your width along the buffer is addressed in each of those sections too within the planting requirements, so evergreen space no more than 15 feet on center, deciduous space no more than,
et cetera. Yeah, it wasn't clear. When I just read it, it just read like, the depth of the buffer, it was 50 by 10, one tree, and let's say if it was 50 feet, then you'd have five trees in a 50 by 50 buffer.
No,
that's what was important. That to me just seemed even horribly inadequate for like Cedar Falls Way, which we know the density is far higher there.
But here's
that's not my question, because that's what, yeah. And I'll put this in for the record, because this is the exact question. So
let me draw this for the Planning Commission. So imagine, for example, that you've got a 15-foot landscape buffer to an adjacent property.
Like, are these lights not applicable?
Oh, it's not that. Yeah.
And I was also more concerned, like, street buffers. That was really the specific example. You keep going. So.
Yeah, this could apply to a street buffer.
Okay, thanks. This helps me, actually.
So imagine there's a street. So a 15-foot landscape buffer, it requires a tree every 15 feet on center. Maybe you're staggering them. But the average has to be no more than 15 feet on center. What the current regulation had a deficiency was, it just prescribed that same spacing no matter how deep the landscape buffer was. So if you've got a 30-foot landscape buffer, it required the same number of trees. So you're getting half the amount of trees overall. And this is saying for every 10 feet,
right, right.
You've got that many trees to do. So now you're suddenly doing this, right?
One of the things was surrounding, not all buffers are nice 10-foot increments, so that's something to think about. So I think the interpretation then was correct then. So it was sort of one tree for every 50 by 10 section is still how I read that. Is how I read that 1880 C part is on page 11. That's to me was
Michael. Are you saying the intent doesn't match the diagram?
No, I mean it wasn't really clear to me how we were when I read this. It was like one tree for every 50 by 10 foot area. Is how I interpreted that. Under page 11 was under the visual buffer. So it was a number of required trees shall equal the length of the landscape area divided by 50 for every 10 feet of buffer. So a 50 by 10 area.
For every 10 feet of buffer.
Yeah, so that's only one. So let's say you had a 30 foot wide buffer. That would be three trees every 50 feet.
Right.
In that buffer. Is that the intent?
No, so it's evergreen. Let's use the evergreen for an example. Evergreen trees no more than 15 feet on center. So 45 feet, you're going to have three trees there.
But that's all you. Is that all that's required?
And then when
that's
you go
all
back,
that's required now. Yeah. But what this is saying is for every 10 feet. So if you've got a 20 foot buffer, you're going to double that.
Yeah, when I read it, it said one. So it appeared that it was one tree. So that's.
If you put the for every 10 feet of landscape buffer width at the beginning of that sentence, mm-hmm. that might I see what you're
that's what I
can see
about.
How you're reading it, but that what you're really saying is you want the 10 feet of buffer width to be your initial okay. measuring tool,
right? Yeah. And your spacing
and
within that has to meet the minimum spacing, and then when you add another 10 feet, you have to meet the minimum spacing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't clear. It wasn't obvious the number, and also there was some grounding. Like, what do you do with a 35-foot buffer? Because that was actually the standard proposed for Cedar Falls Way. So it's not an even multiple of 10. So, I'd like to see it rounded up, but I'd still say four trees every 50 feet.
I think what you do in that case is if you're half an additional, you're not meeting the standard because it's additional area. You used up your 10 feet, so now you have to do it again.
Well, I've had arguments with some right. people over grounding. So.
Right. Well, I think that's how we would interpret it.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, it could be a little clearer, though. That was my question.
Yeah, we could change the language there, but I think the intent is to try to make sure that we have the greater the depth, the more trees you're going to get.
Yeah, no, and that's what I saw. It's just that density was like, wow, that's really nowhere near the density mm-hmm. that we have in some of our heavily tree roots. So that was another concern.
Now, one of the things we're looking at, too, is tree health. In some cases, some of those heavily buffered areas, you have trees, being damaged because they're planted too close together. So we want to make that happen, too.
All right, Mr. Ryan has comments.
Thank you. A question that was at the last commission meeting. We had a consensus that the community language that was leaning forward towards climate change, we're relying upon numerical data about native and non-native species, but I believe our advice was to put in some parenthetical comments about subject to change based upon the science of climate change becoming better understood. Some of our native trees are going to be falling into that middle zone where they might become more drought-stricken than normal. So we need to be aware of that as we start thinking about landscape issues, so that we would, the document would appear to be more contemporary, talking about climate change and species alterations as climate change becomes better established. Mm-hmm. I think knowing about that in advance, talking about it in the public arena would be good for us to
show. Maybe something in the intent could be mentioned, and then one of the things that we've try to intersperse, and we have in our existing landscape ordinances, to look toward drought-tolerant species because that's where climate change takes us. So we might put something in the preamble here in the intent just to recognize the fact that that's going on.
Just to get the issue in the document.
Yeah.
Good comment.
I think we need to which side that left me, but I didn't see anything.
We'll put it in.
I try my best in the very limited time that I have to respond to all the comments, and I'm going to just naturally miss some of them, but
it's okay.
I'll try to get everything that I can.
You're crazy.
Mary, did you have anything?
That was a really good comment. I don't have anything specific other than I had a couple of questions about the mapping in here. It's more related to one question, first of all, are these available for the public to see at all times when they're, can a public person come into the public works and see?
Our zoning app or the
zoning change?
The edits. The edits and anything like that. Is that open to the public?
Yeah. Okay. For example, we post the landscape amendments to the municipal or to the website.
Well, thank you for that. I just wanted to be clear. One of my questions is on the keys here. With that being said, I see a couple of things that are, you know, I asked a friend the other day, I said, do you know what MBR is? Well, you all
that's
might know
what
that is.
That's our next section, though.
Where is that?
Well, no, our next topic.
Oh, shoot.
It is MBR. That's very good.
But, yeah, I have those same questions.
Sorry. Okay.
I guess we'll just finish up with the landscaping regulations, and then we'll get into that one.
Talk about that later.
Okay.
Thank you.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Get me on track there, Scott.
All right. Well, do you have anything else here? Okay. Yeah, I was just going through the comments that Mike put in there. You said you wanted to talk about the 60%.
The native content. So we did hear from the Planning Commission at the last meeting that you were interested to increase that from 50 to 60. But you also suggested that we run that by our landscape consultant for his opinion on that. And I included that in the packet. He actually suggested not going over 50%. His rationale was that there's a lot of landscape species that are not native that are very well adapted to drought tolerance. And he thought that there's just as many native species that are susceptible to drought and problems as there are ornamental species. That is coming from the perspective of a landscape designer, though, so I think he's going to have a natural tendency to want to have maximum flexibility for creating creative landscapes.
Well, that comment does kind of reinforce Dick's comment about the changing climate, and you know what you may have as native may not be in the future, and we want to be able to have some flexibility to adapt to that. The other thing that you find that I've heard a lot of arborists talk about is some tree diversity helps you when disease hits. So that might protect against that a little bit and having a little bit more diversity in the community. And I've heard that from a lot of folks. And we've had, I mean, whether it's Dutch elm disease or other diseases that have affected, you know, really robust street tree programs, which has decimated them. So a little bit of variety in terms of tree health is something we're looking for, too.
Particularly under Douglas Fir community, where there's drought, black stain is very rampant. Black stain will kill a 20-year-old tree in a day. It's gone. Mm-hmm. Black stain is very powerful. It doesn't waste any time on it. It takes it out very fast. The needles all cast off, and your best thing to do is cut them down and burn them. So having closely grown Doug Fir without I like in neighborhoods a mix of fir and hemlock and a few other species that are northwestern coastal, but a complete fir tree in a landscape environment, you're risking devastation.
Does that respond to your?
I think my comment was actually at 75% is what I had said. So I mean at 60. You know, I mean, I would say, yeah, that's the minimum. I did read Jim's comments. I think, I mean, honestly, he's quoting outlier species, like a native Pacific Madrone that's really, like, Seattle-based. It's, like, kind of on the bluffs. Like, it's a really poor example. I mean, it's kind of like the truth, like, in a real hidden way. But, I mean, we don't really have Pacific Madrone here, so it's like, yeah, they're going to do more poorly. Sure, why would they do good here? So native green ash, I think he's referring to the Oregon ash, and that's a wetland species. So no, you would not put that in a housing development area.
Something that he wasn't really speaking to that I heard from the planning commission at the last meeting was one of the things that was important for the native content wasn't so much adaptability as it was also character, character to our surrounding natural environment. Mm. So that's, again, it's more of a look and feel thing than it is about the science, the suitability.
Yeah, and those are native, what he's quoting there, but those are species that, no real, landscaper would select those species anyway. So those are kind of out, so those aren't, I think a point to make here is it's not just trees, and that's not what I was referring to. I was actually kind of thinking shrubs in a lot of ways, because you get a lot of these species that might look pretty. It's not about if they're successful or pretty. It's just keeping with the natural character. And plus, we know they're successful because they're all around us. Those are species that some aren't necessarily pretty, but they do well, and you don't feel like you're just in some kind of artificial area. You have to remember too that people can do whatever they want in their gardens too. So this is outside of those areas. If you don't want echinacea in their yard, go for it. Put in some, I don't know, there's tons of stuff. People can experiment. So looking at like snowberry, ocean spray, red flowering currant. I saw some of those in the development that one that's by the church, that cottage development. So along there are some native shrubs in there. So I know that they're used. So I think that I wouldn't go below the 60%. I don't know if anyone has any comments on the new commissioners or anyone else as far as percentage of native species.
That's what I was trying to drive at a little bit, Scott, was I thought if we went over 50% on native species, we might run into problems long range in terms of climate change. But I think when that begins to happen, we're going to be realizing that and making judgments about that. But I'm saying that it may be wise to look ahead at that and maybe not go heavy native.
We could also be kind of flexible with what we're considering a native. So a ponderosa of pine would be highly drought tolerant. Is it native particular to this area? Not necessarily, but it is native to Washington.
Yeah.
And that's maybe that adaptability as climate may change, we could consider.
I don't find pine species doing well on the west side, but there are pockets where they do. You ponderosa, they're doing great, but it's a microclimate situation. So if you have that and you're aware of it, and if you're like Scott, you're going to put in a nice pine tree that's going to grow there and it's going to be vibrant. And with that comes different bird species that occupy pine versus others. So it's all part of it. But I respect Scott's focus on more than majority non-native or non-native, because I think, coming from his background, he knows what he's talking about. He has a good thought there, but I just, I'm putting on my ageism hat, and I can see changes happening now that I didn't see 50 years ago. So the clock isn't that narrow. It's getting narrower and narrower, is what I'm trying to say. So that's my point.
So for consensus sake, what we're picking now?
Well, it's 60 as written.
60, yeah. Is that acceptable to the group, or is there a desire to increase it beyond that?
I'm fine with 60.
Okay.
I'm
okay.
60, yeah.
Okay, good.
Let's see. Yeah, so one of the comments that I had before was to, and I think this would help, because I think people are a little confused. They're like, well, what plants are you talking about? So I see that Mike added in Kirkland Native Plant List. If you go to the King County Native Plant Guide, because you've referenced that before, so I didn't. It is like, it's east and west side, because we're really talking about Western Washington here. I mean, yeah, you could pull one over for climate change. I understand the climate change points. That's great to say, to think about. It's not happening that fast. We don't need to plant for climate change right now. We don't. But we need to think about it. And if we need to modify in 5 years, sure. Mm-hmm. But we don't need to put in, oh, well, climate change happened. We need to put this down to 30%, drought tolerant. It's not quite that fast.
So, to your point, I think that just mentioning it is sufficient.
Yep.
Shows that we thought about it. We're aware of climate change. We're not writing this landscape document without thinking about it. We're aware of climate change, and it should be in the language, but it should be dominated. And I think you are on the same page on this.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess where I'm going with it, and what I commented last time was, you have an extensive table for street tree species. I've commented before, and there's nothing wrong with that. If you want to have all that information in there, that's great. But I guess that is not there for the native species, and so
I think the reason for that is we are trying to limit the street tree species to those that we've determined suitable. Okay. Whereas natives, we consider everything suitable within the climate geography of this area.
Okay.
And
fair enough. I think it could dumb it down for people, though. And we could have a list so that it's ones that are successful. Because if you go to King County Native Plant Guide, it lists every single species that exists. I mean, it's like hundreds. I would say there's probably about 15 to 20 shrubs that would be good to plant here, you know, and probably 10 trees, at least. I mean, maybe 15 conifers and deciduous, you know, getting to ground cover, you know. So, I mean, that's just a comment. I'm not saying, you know, it's just, you're putting a lot on the developer, and you just might get different things back, you know, and you might say, well, plants aren't successful, we got to have these other ones. Well, if we use successful native plants.
Well, we do have landscape review, and we do review what they submit for suitability. And there has been a lot of times that they have provided things that really are not applicable or suitable, so we'll comment back that there's a reason that that's.
I just happened to see it on Kirkland's native plant list. Like, I looked at that, and they had kind of about 20 shrubs. So it's a way to do it. Maybe we'll get there. Maybe we're just not there yet. Maybe we're too small, or maybe, you know, we just haven't quite thought about that yet. But it's not a bad thing. We've kind of done that in similar in other avenues of planning, where we've kind of made a short list.
Perhaps if we had suggested native plants and not just limited, to give them some guidance as they move forward, that would be really good.
I mean, I hear what Mike's saying. You know, you want to leave it open.
Yeah.
And if they have some, you know, good people on staff, then I'm sure that the developer can make it happen.
Yeah.
Does anybody on the table have any development experience themselves?
Yeah.
Is it true or not true that, let's say, developer X has got a large 200 house project planned, and he orders landscaping materials to be grown in the ground or whatever to meet a certain installation time frame, then all of a sudden his project goes sideways by half? What happens to the landscape material that was growing for that project? I mean, it doesn't take that half. Does it continue to grow in place for the next guy, or is that already potted?
Well, it depends on, you know, if somebody builds half a project and he sells the rest of it and isn't going to finish it, then usually people, given what you have to go through in the entitlement process, they either have a really good idea that they're willing to go through the process again and suffer all of the uncertainties and the costs, and they have to go through the landscape review as well. Or if, say, the guy did a perimeter landscaping, he's not going to landscape the rest of it. He's still under the 3-year bond. He's still under, you know.
But he has inventory on hand that he has to get rid of. Is that potentially becoming surplus plants that may be discounted to the next contract we buy about halfway? The plants aren't as viable at that point?
Any smart guy will not do that. Will not go out. He's buying what he's going to use, and they usually put the landscaping in most cases, toward the end of the project. That's where I see it, particularly in commercial. So you're not going to buy a bunch of plant material and leave it out there and have to take care of it.
So what control do we have as the city who is watching the installation of the landscaping? Do we have the ability to verify the efficacy of what's going in, or is it just taking?
Yeah, well, that's why we have the amendments and some of the other requirements we're talking about. And in some areas where we have problems with, say, for instance, the sidewalks and things like that, we require that they put the root barriers in and things like that. So there's quality control in the field with all of that. As a matter of fact, you've seen with some of these bioswale areas not functioning properly because they before they put the landscaping in, they put a lot of garbage in the area, or they have their chips, floating into the area and it plugs it up. We require them to clean all of that out. We require them to make sure that anything they have like that that could be fugitive and get in there, if they remove it. So, there's quality control in the field, particularly given the fact that you've got street trees that we're going to inherit, you've got bioswale areas that have to be maintained, and we have a lot of that in this community. So there's an awful lot of oversight. In terms of the trees, we're now having Jim go out on site, look at root pruning and things like that, and what's going on in the field. You have protective fences, and they get moved, you'll catch it. So, there are some quality control issues in the field.
I just want to come back to the plant list idea to get the consensus of the Planning Commission, and I want to take your recommendation on this, but let me respectfully push back a little bit, in that one of my goals as a planner overall is to put our code on a diet, and wherever I can, I want to reduce and simplify. And I know that's great information for developers to go to, but I'd rather just make a reference to where they can go find information rather than try to put it all within the code itself.
Can I make a suggestion? I agree with you about putting the code on a diet. I think that's a really smart thing. Maybe we can just take out the street tree list also and just refer to, for the street tree list and for the native plant list, about the city's approved plant list, and then just make that an administrative function.
That could work.
I mean, I don't see why we have to have the tree species in set of regulations.
The thing that I do know that we want with the street trees in particular is the kind of the planting criteria about what's suitable for what width of planter strip and what needs a root barrier. Mm-hmm. I don't want to just kind of leave that up to guesswork or to unknowns.
But could you just take all of, for example, the table 2 and just make that? I'm assuming there is some authority for the director to adopt administrative rules or director's rules and just make that part of the director's rules. That gives you some flexibility if you find that there's a certain street tree species that maybe there's new information. Maybe Issaquah's planted it and they're having issues with the roots not doing what they thought it was going to do. You could just take it off the list without having to come back through this process.
Change the ordinance. I like that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that would be good is to have the kind of performance standards notes with it, so wherever you flag with a particular notation that you have to put a root barrier in with that particular tree, it's in those guidelines, and we use those as kind of a working tool. A good idea.
Or even a subsection, of that list that this subsection applies to this area in the code.
Yeah. And then you could do what Scott's suggesting too, and have that, kind of hot list of different native species to have, and their suggestions, but they're not absolute requirements.
Right, and you wouldn't have to change them if things change later and go back to code.
Right.
Good tool.
Thank you.
Good suggestion.
I could work with you on that. Mike.
That would be helpful.
Okay. Well, I have on page 18, there's a comment added 18.18.150 and talks about landscape maintenance. And I think it hit one part of what I was concerned about, and that's the way it's written, it keeps invasive species out of those landscaped areas. Mm-hmm. So the way I read it, it's kind of like those ones that come up after planting, which I think it totally happened, just with birds or wind or whatever kind of vectors out there. What I was also looking at was to clear out all invasive species on the lawn. I think I asked during the clearing and grading, I think you mentioned that this was the place you wanted to do it, this chapter. but I don't.
Yeah, no, that's a really good comment.
I think before I had just in my notes last mm-hmm. meeting had it in like either the general requirements or, you know.
If you didn't catch it in the search, we need to insert it. So mm-hmm. we'll find the right place for it. But I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
You want to get them out of there.
Yeah, just while we're mentioned before final plat or I don't know.
Right.
But yeah, just to wipe those out.
I'm with you there.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I know. I mean, there's other ones in there. Are we going to be looking at this again based on some?
Well, yeah, I think. Yeah, you should see it
okay.
and get it finished before you go any further. There was some comment at CED who got a peek at it, and I think Londi made the comment that she thought that the broadleaf maple were problematic and that we shouldn't be promoting them. She thought they were junk trees because they have shallow root systems and they tend to fall a lot, and I can attest to that. Now, I've only been here 9 months, and we've had at least one come down. Another one's about ready to. And so
the big leaf maple.
Yeah, yeah. They just aren't extremely stable. They also, speaking of invasive species, a lot of these maples get these vines growing on them, and it completely destroys the tree, and the tree dies. And that happens quite often. Yeah.
Ivy.
Yeah, I don't know because they're fairly thick.
They can be this thin or this big.
Right. So it's probably ivy, but she was pretty adamant about that, and I wanted to bring that up before the group to see if there was consensus on that or not.
So these would be prohibited species or just not on the preferred planting list?
Well, we wouldn't want to be promoting them as native species that we are encouraging because of the volatility of the species, particularly when they get larger, and then you get into situations where you have them turning into an attractive nuisance from a nice tree, right? How do you all feel about that? She felt pretty strongly.
Yeah.
I hear you. I can kind of get your telepathy.
I have three on my property. They're all old growth, and they're healthy as hell.
Okay.
So it's where they're planted is the issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in general, I've got one. I mean, I would say cottonwood would be kind of hard to describe where they're kind of exploding on site. I mean, I'm sure that could happen with big leaf maple, but I don't think it's a junk tree.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the leaves kind of get in the way. I mean, they're large and, you know, kind of deciduous trees can be a little annoying in certain places. You know, there were a lot, I think there were several big leaves left at that, I don't know the name of that, the John Day cottage housing over there.
I just wanted to raise it because she raised it and at least let you react.
Cottages. Yeah, so there were some left there.
So how are we doing? Are we pretty much, have we gotten on this
one? Yeah, I think we've got some great comments to work in.
Thank you.
Back to you guys for the next meeting.
I want to keep you moving along because I don't want the new commissioners to quit because they have to be here till
11 o'clock. Yeah, I'm ready to go to sleep.
That would not be a good message to send.
do we have one of the new packets?
I can send these on.
Can they turn on?
Yeah. I'm like, oh.
So, this is a zoning map change, not a zoning code change, as we mentioned before, and it's just for one specific change, which really affects one little area. I will go into the detail. Made a PowerPoint for this, which might be seen as overkill, because this is just an introduction for you guys. But seeing that there's a few new folks, including myself, I figured this, why not? You kind of help me walk through it. So, go through kind of an overview of why this is taking place, the specific affected area, and then a brief overview of the zoning differences. So this is of a specific area being changed from cottage residential to low-density residential. And then we'll go over the process timeline, where it takes place and where you guys are involved. All right. So in January, council got together on a retreat to discuss zoning within the city. It's kind of hard to see the details up there right now, but if you look at your packet, it's the same map. Specifically tonight, we're talking about Area 12, which is, here, well, the next slide shows a specific area, but there's a lot of changes going on, but once again, this is just cottage residential changing to low-density residential, which is really in only one specific area. That specific area is the brighter yellow in there. The dimmer yellow just kind of shows the people that we needed to notify for the CEPA process. But that's Stilson Avenue, the north-south, on the left-hand side. So every property abutting that, as well as, so that's Southeast North End Way to the north, Cedar Falls Way to the south, and then 436th, which goes to the interstate, just to kind of give you a clear picture of the land cover currently. I rotated that a little bit to fit the image, fit the shape of the slide a little better. But we've got lower density residential already existing around Stilson, some unencumbered land, and then I believe that's cottages at North Bend. This was an image taken in 2016, so that was just a construction site then. And then the church farthest to the east. So kind of the move behind this was that cottages, the council believes, is are for more of a central commercial area, walking distance to amenities, whereas this area is a bit east of the central core. So it's more appropriate with the current land use and just the position of it relative to the downtown core to be low-density residential. So specifically what this means, and this is just an intro, so I won't dive into it too much, but the big thing is it's going to be changing from 6 to 10 dwelling units per acre down to 4 dwelling units per acre. So it's essentially a down zone. So this the rural character that we've been discussing tonight will be preserved better with this change. Downside is less potential inventory of new housing. And so the process that takes place, I've already sent a notification to Washington State Department of Commerce, prepared a CEPA checklist. Tonight, you guys are getting an introduction. In the next couple weeks, we will be mailing to all those homeowners within 300 feet of this area, as well as posting on the website, and then everybody that is relative to the State Environmental Protection Act, we will be mailing them and notifying them of the change. June 8th will be sent to Snoqualmie Valley Record, and then we'll have public hearing, and then we will circle back to everyone here on July 12th, and a few weeks after that, City Council will hopefully approve. And there's a few other odds and ends that need to get taken care of from then. So,
and the main reason for doing this is to try to keep the low density compatible with the neighborhood, and to concentrate on cottage. You know, we had the map up of 3/4 mile. We haven't really come up to a final decision on all the zoning changes, but certainly this particular area was far enough away that the council felt strongly that the folks in the area would like the lower intensity and that we should move in that direction. Generally speaking, we like to, where we can, increase density, particularly near the downtown, and make that happen. But you know, we're not in the same boat as the cities within the urban core. And we are trying to honor our rural character, and we've heard a lot of comments about doing that. And this is one measure to do that in one section of the other community.
Duke it out. Can
you put the map back up there, please?
The
zoning map. Sorry, zoning map.
So
still kind of hard to see.
Yeah, it's in your packet as well.
Yeah. So I just wanted up there because I had a question. So 2D, so I got that. But I had a question. So to the west of area number 12, mm-hmm. is that also currently zoned cottage residential? It looks like it's the same color.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that also going to be changed?
We're not looking at that yet, and we but the council was considering that. They felt that this area definitely. There are a number of ideas they brought up on this map, and they really want to spend a lot more time with it because we didn't have consensus on all of them, and we prepared the map to come back to them to say these are the ideas you folks bounced off of us. So, are you sure you want to do this? And because they weren't all in concert.
And then a couple follow-up questions on that. So if the logic is that this is not as appropriate for cottage residential because it's farther away from downtown area, then it would make sense to me that maybe the area I just described to the west also changes.
Mm-hmm.
So is that something that the Planning Commission could not recommend per se that it gets downzoned, but as part of this action when it comes
mm-hmm.
to say as a separate item we'd actually sure. the council to consider that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, I think that's all I have.
Yeah.
So one other council on this wisdom. Just discount the fact that for half a mile on the other side of the street's going to be commercial. You know, all that blue is going to be is intended for the use of the population that is now a mile and a half away from the city, and it's going to be a convenience issue for the residents there. They're going to have to get in a car and drive to downtown to get stuff. So the idea here is, as I understand it, during this planning phase, that blue area, which would be neighborhood commercial, is to satisfy the needs of the community living in that area and easterly. So maybe that's all changing too.
Well, you can see there are a number of notes on this map, and I don't know where all of that's going to go. But they are definitely going to tackle this again, and it's going to come before you as well. So I'm one of the things that we asked them to do, because of the reaction of the business community, was to the greatest extent possible try not to be changing zones where businesses are located, where it would make them non-conforming, because it puts them in a real bad position. They are concerned that some of the zoning that is neighborhood commercial and fronts on the Snoqualmie Valley Trail ought to be a different use, because they don't think commercial up against the trail is appropriate. They're thinking that, and some of the things they discuss is maybe the cottage is better off over there where you can walk directly to commercial without having to cross North Bend Way, and you could have a frontage along the trail where you could have access. So,
but the Kendall's still zoning under the tent. You have apartments going in just south of the church on the side mm-hmm. of the road. That's going to be apartments. You got a lumber yard going in right now. It's been graded. You got a commercial corner on 436th and North Bend Way. We're going to go high density all the way east. I mean, the state is already being set for having commercial close to that 436th interchange.
One of the differences that I think the council is looking at with that neighborhood business zone though is focusing it more towards service business. So car wash, power repair, those types of things that you don't necessarily want to be downtown, but there needs to be a place for it. And I think the cottage's relationship to the commercial that they're looking for is more like a restaurant, retail, and grocery store.
And I think the blue section there does, it's representative of what's there. Like you said, it's they're not places people are walking to, you know. So, I mean, yes, it's nice if something did come in to have higher density near that, but at the same time, it's commercial there now, and who's to say it's going to change to a restaurant or something that's more something you'd want to walk to in the first place.
Mike, there's just a historical point here along the road, too. Pretty sure, I don't know if it was this year or early last year, we actually approved and moved forward that this area in question would be all cottage. So now it's back at us for
because, yeah, the council did give their direction. They wanted to take this to the process specifically. So the Planning Commission's really recommendation on that was was just a recommendation to accompany the cottage regulations, but we hadn't taken that back through the full public process to notify property owners. That would have taken place had the Planning Commission recommended.
I think this was cottage already, right?
It is.
And then they asked us, like, hey, do you want to make a quick change? We said, let's just move forward with it because that's what it is and see if development comes in. And now it's back. So they weren't able to just make the change right there. They had to run it back through us again.
No, they adopted the cottage regulations, but when they did that, they also looked at this situation and they considered the Planning Commission's recommendation. But their feeling was, we really want to take this back through the process and notify those property owners about this potential change.
That is one of my comments. See what the public has to say about it. The reason if you put that aerial up there,
mm-hmm.
that has the background. So and I think what Mike said in this intro, or maybe it was Jesse, is what you're really talking about here is a one big parcel,
right.
Because you've already got LDR to the west. Okay, you got a church over there that's not changing, and you have cottages right there. They're kind of like. It's not the cottage zone that we ultimately pass. That's kind of almost like HDR in some strange way. I don't know. It's just, it's a little bit different than what we were going for cottage. So you still have trees there, though, that you could, as Michael says sometimes, you can incorporate around. So you have some existing vegetation. And that was one of the reasons that the cottage zone to the west, that we had that as it is, because there are existing trees there. So that's a
well, yeah, benefit. I think one of the feelings that the council had, particularly with some of the reactions to cottage development occurred, obviously the reaction was rewrite the whole code because we don't like the way those things. The other thing is, part of what happened there was just what Michael was talking about, a big clear cut. If you have lower density residential in this area, which you also have nearby, there's a greater potential for saving one of those trees. You could, within cottage, if you had the proper buffer, one of the problems that we saw also was some of the cutting up of the land in this area and how do you accumulate those parcels to be able to do cottage. We do have some proposals that had come in for cottage development further to the west, and we really emphasized them shielding the street on the frontage by leaving those trees in and having a buffer along the street. And part of what the council said, if you don't have any active projects in this area, we'd like it lower density. We'd like to be able to save more of the trees and things more compatible with the area nearby, besides which it's not close to the downtown. We told them we did have a project that the people were processing next to that, and I think that might have influenced some of the decision as to whether or not to change that now, because your very comment about is it viable, are people going to propose a project on it that will work, we're kind of testing that.
Yeah, that was just our, I think the commission, the prior commission, maybe the commission here now, that just let's just leave it as is, and why are we rushing to change this? This is what it feels like again, just as an introduction.
Well, they saw, of course, that it didn't make a difference with the church. They didn't like this cottage development. They thought the line of demarcation was better closer to the downtown. They had a different point of view.
I understand that side of it, that you want things closer, but we also want housing diversity, not
right.
Just a town of LDR. So that's where I get like torn on that argument.
Yeah, it's been kind of hard for us to sell the cottage development without implementation of the new ordinance because they're not happy. So it kind of has a black eye right now.
Yeah.
The Planning Commission has every right to make your same recommendation should you choose to do so back to the council, but no, we don't feel like this should change the way it's in this council to do, if that's what you find out.
But I think if you do that's a good point, but I think if you do that, you should have some findings to back it up, some kind of evidence that you can present that supports the argument that's credible.
Sure. I'm in the same boat. I think I'm kind of torn. I don't like the idea of leaving the cottages as is. And changing everything to LDR around it, I think that's going to look, like long term, that's going to look kind of goofy, right? You're going to have these higher density surrounded by low density that we're now changing. But at the same time, I think that I agree with the council in the sense that I like the idea of the low density that far out. It appears from the changes that you have marked here that there's a lot, we're losing a lot of the cottage residential zoning. There's only one place where it's adding, but they have a whole other section here that's currently zoned cause residential going to MBR. I didn't know that. That's, again, new to this, but is that a response to cause residential?
I wouldn't take anything seriously about any of the other zoning recommendations, because we probably shouldn't have even labeled it proposed zoning, because what they did is they had a workshop and they were all over the map. We tried to get where we had enough votes where we could get a majority, we tried to put them on the map, but I don't think they're totally settled on that.
Can someone explain what MDR is? It's the first time I've seen this.
Yeah, that's the idea of that was that it would be basically the equivalent density to what cottage residential is in the 6 to 10 units per acre range, but it's not cottage specific. It would allow for single-family attached,
it's literally medium density residential. I'll give you an example. Near the downtown end, which we do allow in the downtown commercial, we have, and I'm currently processing a townhouse project. We haven't ever had them proposed in the city. In fact, we have a code restriction against zero setbacks for single family. We didn't think about single family attached. And that's a housing type for affordable housing that one can buy and get in under all of the single family prices. And so we're going to change the code to do that and be able to have that level of density in areas where it's appropriate. We just don't have the zoning category now, nor do we have the regulations that are necessary to evaluate a townhouse project. But it's a very much needed housing type in the community.
What would be the implications to these homeowners if that change were into effect?
Well, for those who are in single family homes within the area that would allow it, it wouldn't have any change. I think that the sentiment, now for the homeowners that are here,
yes,
when you have lower density nearby, everybody likes it. I mean,
but for their particular property,
they be non-conforming.
Does it make them non-conforming?
It's a non-conforming size, but that's not going to do anything because it's already built. Nobody's going to try to change
what they can do.
Right. And the other thing is, I think we need to maybe blow up a little bit, expand a little bit on why they don't like the development that was built, and they feel that the housing sizes that were allowed and the development community kept pushing it toward a larger and larger housing size.
That was my other question.
And all of a sudden, they're not cottages anymore.
That was my other question.
And the cottages are supposed to be lower profile. And when you combine two elements, you combine the element of having to measure the height to the top of the roof from finished floor because you have the flood elevation issue. You can't construct the typical trusses and all that kind of thing if you're measuring from the ground level because you've just cut off the top of the thing. It would look terrible. So you combine those with the square footage they were able to achieve, and all of a sudden you have this kind of half, regular home, half cottage thing that didn't come out very well. And it really looks like they're packed up against one another. And, you can pass a beer to the guy in through his window out yours. It's not allowing you the kind of space that you need to have. And if they were lower profile, and if they were oriented around an open space area like they were supposed to be, and you have that relief of the open space as something you could look across from unit to unit, then you're starting to get toward the cottage, and they have to be lower profile. They can't. And what the reason they did this, and I kind of joked with your fellow commissioner that will be in there that was promoting the cottage larger units. I said, I get what you want. You want the lower fees, but you can't have the lower fees and not build a cottage. So if you want the lower fees, you have to downsize it, right size it to the cottage profile that we were sold and the council was sold.
Right. So that was my other question. Is the product, is the development, is it a product of the zone, or is it a product of the development regulations associated with the zone? And if you don't change those, would you see the same
project? We've readopted the code, dumbing it down to what it really needs to be.
Okay.
Maximum size, it has to be one story in the development. It has to be around a green space. I mean, we've really, really gotten prescriptive about if you have a visual image you want to produce, how are you going to do it, and how could you violate it?
Right.
So we cut off the loopholes to violate it.
So when I was looking at the zoning definition, definition, and I was up a little bit about what is a cottage, because when I see one, I said, my vision of a cottage wasn't that. And I was just,
neither was the council.
Yeah, yeah. I thought I saw something about 1,700 square feet.
That was the prior standard.
That's been changed.
Well, yeah, we knocked that
we out. Just went through it like it's a couple months ago.
So okay. That was, the cottages were originally smaller. The recession hit. Nothing was happening. And the developers were saying, no, we need bigger cottage size. Nobody's going to buy this. It's just...
Once you really learn something from that, because we're not immune to recessions. When I was in the former city that I worked for, we allowed a kind of an Orange County type product be introduced in our community in the Sierra foothills, which was a big mistake. And it was during the recession, nothing was happening, the council caved. Guess what happened? They couldn't sell the units, and they priced them wrong too. So they had to down the prices, and it was a phased development. And when we came out of the recession, nobody would buy any more of them. So they had to come in and lose 40 units and go to the larger lot size. So recession should not dictate the urban form of the community. If things don't work during the recession, wait till they do.
Yeah. I think we had 1,500 as a max, but the majority were 1,200.
That's right.
Room at square feet. So more. So I think overall they're looking really good now. Nothing has been built to those new standards yet, of course, because there's things that are vested already. So that's why.
We have had people,
good things to come.
We have had people spending a fair amount of money and trying to make it work according to code, and they're telling us it can with today's housing prices. So hopefully we'll get a good cottage development in here and everybody will be proud of it.
How many homes would be in that large lot? So like if it was LDR, is that something you can answer right now? Or?
You're talking 4 to the acre. I don't know what the acreage is.
Yeah, I don't know.
Looking at the other one, that's about 8 acres, so half a number of that. That's 20 or so, well, roughly.
At least you have the opportunity to save more trees with the lesser.
So I'm thinking it's not all about the trees. I mean, it's about, I think that you can create a pretty cool community. Put those regulations in there, mm-hmm. and you can buffer along the road. You can mm-hmm. have the central green. You can have a little forest in there, or at least scattered trees, and you can have that community building. And so people are talking, you have to walk a distance downtown. Well, for services, but you would have your little space there, mm-hmm. and the community there. So that's, I think there is that opportunity.
I would encourage you, when it comes to you for hearing, and if that is the consensus, you ought to really articulate that well. The other thing I think might be effective, and I think it's perfectly fine to do, is if either the chair or you have somebody who is particularly articulate and wants to appear at the public hearing before the council and say, this was our reason, and this is why we felt that way, because... In person, you have a lot better opportunity to increase the level of communication. And it may be taxing to go there, but I think we have an issue now where the communication needs to get better. And I think if you have somebody who's a very good spokesperson and can lay out the arguments that you're laying out very articulately, you can influence the decision. There's no question about it.
That's still similar to the scenario right there, as well as a couple of that's extremely difficult to develop because there are significant trees in there. These are not your 12-inch, these are like 24-inch and above significant trees along that road. So you might get a lot of support for moving it as you know, you want to see on. So I mean, if you think about significant trees, I mean, that stretch is still some awesome trees. And if you want to keep those, then you have to give up that privilege.
And one point of clarification on that, too, is on Stilson. Recommended, and it got put into the regulations that Stilson itself, even though it was in a cottage zone, was going to be developed per the LDR standards for the preservation of trees and preservation of the character.
Yeah. Thanks for coming.
Will there be any more information? I guess this is just, it's very brief, and I mm-hmm. see what, I guess it would be good to hear if you're talking about being articulate from our behalf. I would like to hear more of a rationale from CED or council. I did pick it out, kind of. Cottages ideally should be located within walking distance of commercial zone of services. So that's all I hear. For
when we bring it to you, we'll
okay.
bullet those.
Yeah, that'd
because
be
you just heard one from Mike.
Okay. Yep.
So there are several reasons,
yep.
And we'll make those very clear.
Okay. Sounds good.
Are we good? Just an introduction to
yeah.
it.
Okay.
No action necessary.
That's good. Anything for the good of the order? Our time, if there's any other, I don't know, any development things you saw, or just any other random question, comments.
Good introductory meeting for me.
Yeah.
I learned a lot from
crash course.
All of you. Crash course, yeah. Which Dave, you said it would be, right? So just appreciate the dialogue and the conversation.
Just a reminder to you all that your next meeting is not going to be here. We're going to be over at the Senior Center for that short course on local planning, so that'll be a great either education or refresher on planning law and the roles of the Planning Commission, all sorts of good information for you as planning commissioners.
And thanks to Mike for doing that. We did it primarily for new commissioners. I know, Scott, you've probably seen it many times.
Yeah, I'm not going to come.
Yeah.
But I have to do the OPMA training by December 1st. Susie and I have been talking about that.
Good.
But I will tell you that I think the first speaker is the attorney, Mike Walter. Right? Mike's going to be speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And he's phenomenal. You ever seen Mike Walter?
Mm-hmm.
Mike, he's got a big presence and a big voice, and he talks very fast, and he knows his stuff backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
Great guy to learn land use law from.
We really think it's great that Commerce decided to
yeah.
do it. I mean, here we are in Little North Town, and what we've done, we've invited council members, and we invited the other communities around, their planning staff, their planning commissioners, because when you get a training like this locally, you don't have to drive to Seattle or some crazy place. And we like to think that part of making our reputation improved is by bringing these kinds of events here and allowing other professionals to come in and partake.
I'd like to give a shout out to planning staff. I didn't attend this meeting, but the arborist and another planning staff member was coming out to the Tanner Road community to talk about cutting down borderline trees. There, the offer was made to homeowners to have some trees taken down. They may have been concerned about blowover, and that was going to happen sometime this week. I'm not sure when, but
today.
Good show on that to put that kind of a team together.
Great.
Also, like to say that I think by and large the contractors are following the 15 mile an hour zone on Tanner Road for the
mm-hmm.
most part.
Mm-hmm.
I think I know it's hard to keep it at 15 when you're trying to get to your job, but they've been doing that, and they've been doing it
good.
And with a good heart, I think there's nobody trying to press it.
Well, that's good. And do get a hold of Mark Rios if that didn't happen, because he's been pretty emphatic about it.
There's been some new markings on Tanner Road. I wondered if they're getting ready to gear up the road change, or is that still something else?
Is that?
I don't know their schedule on Tanner Road itself. I think they're probably going to defer until after a lot of the construction is,
sure,
at least the infrastructure construction is done.
Going on.
They're probably doing some survey work out there on it.
Yeah.
We have so many projects going on around here. For us to keep up with it is a challenge. And they did do a bus tour recently, and if it's something you guys are interested in, I could talk to Mark about it, just to go around to all the projects that are happening in town and have a look and understand where it's at and how many units are in it and when do they think it's going to be done. But if anybody wants to go around and look at that, just to be aware of what's going on, we'd be happy to see if we can get another tour together.
Yeah.
You probably already know because you're living in the middle of a lot of it, but there's so many going on. It's just really, and you know, we're doing, Mark is really doing some great things. He, for instance, the condition of Maloney Road is just terrible, and so we had a developer that had about $170,000 worth of frontage improvements, And in order to repair the road to the right cross section, it would have cost him another $150, and he screamed. So Mark and I worked on that, and what we're doing is, rather than just put an overlay on crappy stuff, we're allowing them to do a lesser amount of base and use some geofabric, which is a geotextile material that holds and supports the pavement above it, so that you get a lot more life of the road. And they agreed to do that. So we're really socking it to people. We have some older streets where they laid pavement down on just dirt. And so what we're trying to do is to at least give some cross-section that'll give you a longer life. We also have the Harbor subdivision out at the tree farm, and they're going to be going over the same area. So they may end up rebuilding it with a little more, but we get what we can out of them at this time. So there's an awful lot of street reconstruction that goes beyond the bounds of what they're required to do. We use a code provision that says if during construction you destroy a pavement section, you have to come back in and rebuild it to its original condition. Well, if the original condition is bogus, you got to try to, you know, leverage a little bit more out of them so you can get a little bit more street, and that's what we're doing.
All right, motion to adjourn.
Move to adjourn.
All right, second.
Second.
There we go. You're on board.
If you guys don't mind, I'm going to keep recording for the next couple minutes as we leave, because I want to turn on the air conditioner to see if it interferes with the recording, because it's kind of uncomfortably hot in here, and I'd love to run it at future meetings. But
close the windows. I like the music.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, yeah.
Another reason to close the window, it's sludge load time.
It's kind of like traffic. When you're successful in the downtown, those things happen, you know.
Yeah, I have to.
I'll come in for a little while this morning. You'll see a lot of me. I'm not going to come in.
Good.
The casino's nice. They get, you know, they test it up. They just here. They drive a car right
into those spots.
They talk about the building, so it's a little not contentious, but they had some people replace it. We thought it was cheap.
So I'm very active. If you're not going back to the office, I can still.
Oh, that was terrific.